quite have a quorum yet, but we're going to get started. And when we get one, we'll bring the meeting officially to order. But we have a lot to cover, so we'll start with Representative Dean, 2002, and we'll move it when we get actually officially underway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2002 and for the committee's time. House File 2002 deals with Medicare, Medicaid, and our waste, fraud, and abuse in our public programs, and trying to, number one, stop paying the crooks and try to get some of our money back that we are right now wasting on waste, fraud, and abuse within our public programs. It is a big problem. It is one that we have not fully even realized how much obscene waste and fraud there is. We have people who are very much in need of services right now. And as our budgetary situation goes from bad to worse, it is going from unacceptable to intolerable to have the needy stand in line behind the greedy who are taking their money. And the money comes from the taxpayers, as we know. This has become, it has been a problem for many, many years. It has gone from being a overlooked problem.
We do have a quorum, so I'm going to call the meeting officially to order, and we'll move to the Representative Dean. No, you can't, can you? Representative Broad will move House File 2002 be recommended and passed and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I consider myself kind of an adopted person on this committee. And this has really gone from being a hidden problem to a public problem. In 2005, a New York Times article came out about the waste, fraud, and abuse in New York City and detailed a dentist that had billed 991 fake paid claims in a single day. James Minette, the Inspector General, estimates that in New York City up to 40% of all Medicaid bills are, quote, questionable. Governor Pataki estimates that $10 to $15 billion a year is wasted in Medicaid fraud in the state of New York alone. Recently, 60 Minutes, many of us saw an article on a program on 60 Minutes, where it was estimated, according to 60 Minutes, a Steve Croft special, that $60 billion a year is stolen from Medicaid. And one of the crooks who was interviewed on this said that he would wake up every day and look in his bank account and see $20,000 to $30,000 more, and he said it's the only way that he could make Wall Street money. And he said that he was ratted out by a friend of his, and the only reason he wasn't still doing it was because of that. What we also see in South Florida was profiled in that. There is, within South Florida, there are more, just in South Florida, there's more than twice as many health care home organizations than in all of California. In South Florida, there's 22 times higher payments for HIV infusion therapy in South Florida than the entire country combined. So we understand when people talk about $50 to $100 billion a year in fraud, that this is real money, it's obscene, and it needs to be addressed. What House File 2002 does is it says, what are we doing here in Minnesota to address this problem? And the Department of Human Services has a number of staff that work very hard and do the best that they can with what they have. They have antiquated computer systems that are very old and that they have a very limited number of staff, so we are asking them to do work that that we haven't provided either the systems or the personnel to do that. And one of the things that we were looking at doing was saying, well, what can we do to partner with private industry to come in and help us with that? And that's what 2002 does, and it directs the commissioner of DHS to really look at our billings and collection, so that we can go after some of the money that's been stolen, so we can do it retrospectively to look back at our claims history, and we can do it prospectively to say what kind of checks are going out the door. We need to stop the checks that are going out the door in advance so that we can bank that money, And we need to partner with collections agencies to find out what kind of fraudulent money has gone out the door in the past and go after that money. So this, what this does is it directs the DHS to do that. There are 15 responses that different folks have put together for a request for information. So really great companies have said that we know how to solve your problem. We want to help with you. We are qualified to do this, and we can partner with you. So we've got companies that are interested, again, or more than a dozen companies have said we would like to partner with you, and many of them are paid on a percentage of received bills. And I'll give you a couple examples of that were brought up in the request for information. In Los Angeles County, for example, it's about the same size as the state of Minnesota. In a less than a one-year study, they prevented $30 million from going out the door in fraudulent claims from one county about the size of Minnesota, looking at just a pilot project, saved $30 million from going out the door. In another example, an $18 billion state health and human services agency was tasked to look for fraudulent transactions among hundreds of millions of Medicaid claims. When you think about $18 billion, that we look at $20 billion all funds for health and human services over a biennium. So again, this is comparable. They saved over $41 million in taxpayer savings, $27 million in overpayments to health care providers, and $14 million in improper payments. And so what these folks do is they look backwards and forwards. They have sophisticated software that can look at our billings, look at what we're doing. And I'll give you a couple of easy examples. If, let's say, a personal care attendant bills more than 24 hours in a day, that's a flag. They have a system that can go through and do that. We saw that in the legislative auditor's report, so that would be an example. Another example might be hospice care for somebody after they've died. Obviously, we need to stop paying for that. That would match up date of death with hospice care or drugs or other bill payments. And then a very, very common one is to bill Medicaid and Medicare for the same thing and receive separate checks. Another one would be to match up what drugs are actually being sent to patients and what they're being billed for. So are we billing Medicaid for a frontline drug and delivering a generic? Those are some of the kinds of things that, with very sophisticated software, they can go through and determine how many billions of dollars we are putting out the door. And as the debate that we've had over the last week about health care for some of the very, very low income Minnesota single adults and families, we need that money to go to the folks who actually need it. So we need to start protecting the needy from the greedy. And this is a bill that just directs the commissioner to talk to some of these folks and start them working. It doesn't cost any money, and it's something that I think makes some sense to me. I think we have a test fire.
Oh, please. Yes, there is Ms. Rattel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cecilia Rattel, and I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber represents 2,400 businesses throughout the state. And in respect for the committee's time today, I will also be expressing support for Representative Broad's bill, Atkins, and Gottwald bills. We support Representative Dean's bill as well as Representative Broad, Atkins, and Gottwald's for the same reason. They all suggest useful concepts for redesigning publicly funded programs. The status quo for the state's health care programs, GAMC, Minnesota Care, and medical assistance is just not acceptable. They need to be redesigned and reformed so they are sustainable in the long run. The ideas that these bills address, including allowing the commissioner to put out requests for proposals to private vendors, as Representative Dean's bill does, and define contributions as described in Representative Gottwald's bills, encourage public programs to be more cost-effective. Representative Gottwald's bill is the only concept that we've seen that is being offered that is able to make Minnesota care sustainable in the long run. Similarly, Representative Dean's bill simply requires the commissioner to make recommendations to reduce waste, fraud, and abuse, to be able to identify areas that money is being wasted, used fraudulently, and abused in some way is important because it ensures that the money we are spending is being used effectively. With the number of uninsured Minnesotans on the rise, we need to start trying new ideas to find a way to make healthcare sustainable. Though not all the concepts that are before you today are useful, they all set up for redesigning GAMC, Minnesota Care, and medical assistance. We hope that you will mix, match, and delete these concepts into a new design that is sustainable. We hope other ideas are also offered. It is for these reasons that I ask you to pass these bills that support reforming the healthcare system today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness, Rep. Zimbun? Anybody for this witness? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rep. Zimbun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, thank you so much for bringing this forward. I'm very intrigued and very, I think this is a great effort. I want to ask you about, although we're the policy committee, I'm just curious about the issue of that there's no fiscal impact. You know, when we decide to tighten up tax compliance in order to get and go after people who weren't paying the appropriate amount and pull those dollars into the state, we had to spend money for additional tax compliance to get a net benefit of a return from additional warranted collections coming in. Or when we wanted to do mandate reform and get the department to, you know, do more observation of whether mandates were required, do that analysis, we got a very large fiscal note of $5 million put on that project. So I'm very much supportive of this effort, but I'm wondering what the department discussions were like that said, given they're giving it doing an RFP, of how they, on this point, have decided to absorb it or something else has been arranged, and what their expected cost for this might be, even if they're absorbing it.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn. If we were to upgrade the systems that they use and make them buy new equipment, that might be a good use of taxpayer dollars because they would be able to collect a lot more money. That would incur a cost or hire more people to go after more fraud money. That would be a cost. What these firms do is they get paid on a percentage of collection, by and large, not entirely, so that if they bring in money, they get part of it and they return the balance to the state on a negotiated basis.
Mm-hmm. Representative
Bunn. Just a follow-up, because I question to that. Is that something that we currently do in the state in other areas or in other areas within DHS to do a percentage of collections?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, I believe the Department of Revenue does employ some collections that is vendor, private vendor, but I'm not entirely sure. I would have to get back to you.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I'm intrigued by this as well. And, you know, certainly who can argue with the idea of trying to reduce fraud? And, you know, I mean, clearly it's almost free money if you can, you know, stop some fraud from occurring or get some money back that's gone out the door through fraud. But I'm just wondering, you know, here we're in the last year of the Pawlenty administration, and as you know, as everybody knows, he's been governor now. He'll have been governor for 8 years by the end. Why hasn't something like this been discussed previously? Or maybe it has. I mean, the governor, as you know, I think you and I came in the same year, and, you know, it's been all about, you know, we want to reform government. You know, that's been the talk all this time. And, you know, I think the implication of your bill is that the Pawlenty administration hasn't been doing this very well, because surely he's been in charge of this all this time, and the people that he appoints have been in charge of this. So why hasn't it happened, and what makes you think that this is the way to go and is going to be better than what he's been able to do up to this point?
Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe the focus on Medicaid, Medicare fraud has been at the federal level, and it has been only very recently become a public issue, and there has been pressure, but it's something that we should have been looking at 10 years ago, probably. But the best time to plant a shade tree is 25 years ago, the second best time is today, so we might as well get at it.
Can I suggest an amendment to the bill, which would be to change on line 1.12 2011 to 2010 to 2011 and the effective date from 2009 to 2010? Would that be more consistent with where we need to go today?
Yes.
Okay. I would offer that amendment then. So on 1.12 2010, change to 2011, and 1.13, 2009 to 2010. Okay. Any discussion? Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment just for everyone.
We just need to vote on the amendment first.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Representative Bunn.
I just want to make a quick question since we're talking about the terms fraud and abuse, which we do when talking about a number of our programs. Having worked in one specific area of MA funding last year, the dental area, and continuing to work in that area, I just think it's important for everyone in the room to realize that when we say fraud and abuse, sometimes we mean the client, I mean the individual applying, that there's been some kind of misrepresentation of their eligibility in some way. And we had a case of that in our local papers that someone from Wisconsin was claiming to be a Minnesota resident last year and got about $15,000 of MA disability spending on them, but it was caught very effectively by the county in the short term. But sometimes it's that, but also what I'm finding in my study of the MA programs is a lot of it, and this is true specifically with the things you identified as things they're going after, is it's on the provider side, it's on the business side, it's on upbuilt charges, charging for things that are not covered, duplicate charges, things like that. So it's in different places in the system. It's not just, and maybe less often, actually, even the actual person receiving the services, but oftentimes just throughout the system, various ways. The second thing I want to point out about it, in my experience of working on the dental side, is what the agency or others sometimes call fraud or abuse. Sometimes the professionals call something else, a misunderstanding about billing or a difference in practices in terms of what they think is the appropriate level of care for a hard-to-serve population. And we have these conversations going back and forth between dentists and insurance companies and the agencies. And what insurance companies and agencies say call fraud, sometimes the dentists don't consider fraud. They consider it, billing discrepancies or misunderstandings or appropriate practice, actually. So it's a complicated area, and I just wanted us all to be aware that when we use these terms, it's not always what the general public might think of as fraud or necessarily the people they might think of who is doing the fraud. So,
agreed.
Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more thing, Representative Dean. Since presumably if your bill was enacted, presumably, this would be in lieu of some activities that are already being done in state government. And so I'm wondering if you have any estimate of the number of jobs that we wouldn't have, that would be lost or that we could cut, depending on your point of view, from the Department of Human Services or anywhere else in government as a result of your bill. I mean, surely you're trying to not just bring in some of this money that's being lost, but make things more efficient by doing this.
Representative Dean. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there are very few people tasked with this chore at the Department of Human Services. They work very hard. They cover very large geographic areas, and they use very old equipment. I wouldn't see this as taking replacing them, but being in addition to what they continue to do. I don't know the full scope of what they do, but I would assume that they have a lot of responsibilities that would be outside the footprint of prospective or retrospective collection for fraud and abuse, and so I wouldn't anticipate that it would displace anyone.
Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there anybody else in the audience that wants to talk about this? All right. Representative Browder moves her motion that House File 2002 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the as amended. Yes, and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Huntley, and while he's going up, we have the minutes from the March 2nd meeting. Representative Gottwald moves that those minutes be approved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of that say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 3047 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
All right. Go ahead.
And basically, everything that Representative Dean said, I agree with. And this basically would set up, in federal government, nearly every department has an inspector general. And so this would set up an individual in the Department of Human Services, authorize, rather, this person in his office, and that would be to look at the fraud, abuse, and everything that the Representative Dean talked about, which, and probably not as bad in Minnesota as it is in Florida, but there are nationally very serious problems. It's been estimated, for instance, that of the total Medicare payments, about 10% is fraud. Certain parts of Medicare payments, like medical devices, wheelchairs, that sort of thing, there's it's probably 30% fraud. So we need to go after those things. Some of you may remember Representative Simon had a bill last year relating to fraud and abuse. And I don't remember the details of what he did, but it allows us to qualify with the feds so that if we catch some fraud in this area, that we get a portion of the federal savings back as well as our own. I don't remember quite the details, but so that was passed last year. I don't know. I don't have a fiscal note on this. We will get one in my division, and if it looks good, then this will continue. If it doesn't, then it'll be the end of that bill.
Okay.
So I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I think both these bills are really kind of the same. I just different ways to go about it, having vendors or the state or whoever. But I remember in the past when we've done fraud money, I remember 12 years ago we were doing some of this, and it all makes money. Because there's, if you talk to Anoka County came to talking about these things, and they pick up, I don't know, 5-1 or something. So I hope that the note's favorable, and I hope we can find a way to do it that makes sense, that we can make this something we do. So good.
Other discussion. Representative Huntley, when both these bills are going to obviously be in your committee.
Right.
And one thing that we didn't ask that I forgot to ask Representative Dean is what the typical percentage that those private vendors take out of the cut. You know, so it's free money in a sense. I mean, it doesn't cost us anything up front, but we lose stuff on the back end because there's a fee going to the vendors. And I think that we're going to need, what I'd request from you is that when they do the fiscal notes, that we actually do a cost comparison about which is actually the most cost-effective way of spending our public money, and that we compare, you know, the private versus this public model. I think that'd be important for us to know. Have any other states done this? Is this modeled on something?
No, it was modeled on the federal government.
Okay. Any other discussion? All right, seeing none, Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 3047, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Not as amended. Well, it's not been amended. I strike that. All right, all in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay, Representative Thiessen, do you want to go ahead and move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd move House File 3055 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on State and Local Government and everything else they do.
Okay, Representative Thiessen moves House File 3055 be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. And Representative Thiessen, you have an author's amendment, and do you want to do that now?
I would, yes, just to get it in the shape of the bill.
Okay.
It would work.
Representative Thiessen moves the A1 amendment. Okay. All those, is there any discussion to the amendment?
You know, can we hold off on the amendment for a minute?
Sure.
All right.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead then and present your bill?
This is a legislation that updates some work that we did last year on, you'll recall, there was a lot of discussion about combining, merging counties and some proposal that we actually passed out up here that moved in a little bit different direction of how we redesigned service delivery and accountability that ultimately got worked out in the conference committee report and passed into law, and I think is actually a really exciting development for us to move forward on getting counties more involved in decision making, moving away from a very prescribed way of state top down telling counties exactly how to deliver their these human services, and moving more toward a model where we set expectations and provide resources, but the counties can innovate more effectively and get the results that they want. I think a direction we really want to head, and this is really largely an update on as they started to do this work and they figured out things that work and don't work, what this bill is trying to fix some of those problems that have come up in the process. And I'll let the witnesses testify more specifically to the specific areas.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Who's going first here?
I'll go first. Madam Chair, members, Representative Thiessen, Patricia Coldwell with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I want to just give a little more background in addition to what Representative Thiessen had laid out in terms of the legislation that passed last year that provides for some redesign of county services. Just a little bit of background. As some of you might recall, the language that we had that Representative Thiessen authored last year was developed in part in response to the governor's proposal that he referenced in the State of the State last year to create 15 human services authorities with pretty large populations. That seemed to us as a proposal to be overly focused on structure and really not enough emphasis on improving the effectiveness of services by streamlining how we do business and increasing accountability and really trying to move away from some of the procedural kinds of things that often fall within the jurisdiction of this committee and more towards a focus on outcomes. It also did arise out of discussions that counties have had the last several years around the redesign of county government and really looking at the county-state relationship to become more transparent, more flexible, and acknowledge the local government responsibilities that counties have. So what this legislation did that was passed last year provides for counties to voluntarily form these service delivery authorities, or SDAs, and I think you have a one-pager in your packets on this. It also requires development of performance measures over a three-year period of time across all areas of human services, and counties would be held accountable for those performance measures regardless of whether they voluntarily participated in these service delivery areas. And Representative Loeffler, who I think stepped out of the room, that was a bill that she had that was incorporated into this bill. It also, third, establishes a forum for legislators, counties, and the Department of Human Services to review and recommend to the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services proposals from counties that want to form SDAs, service delivery authorities. This can include waivers from state statute or rule or federal law. So that's really one of the primary incentives. If a county can come forward, or a group of counties, and say, hey, we either want to combine our human services operations in one area or in several areas of county government, but in order to do that, we might need some waivers from procedural mandates. This is a better way that we can do that, and the commissioner could use existing authority in law in order to do that. Just a little bit of an update on what's happened since this bill passed. There is a subcommittee that was formed on performance and outcomes that has been meeting since summer. That is co-chaired by Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson from the Department of Human Services and Commissioner Tony Carter from Ramsey County, and they have met almost weekly to begin to work on developing these performance measures. What they've done so far is they've identified these essential services that are specified in the law, and then also, as required in the law, they've developed a process for remedies for counties that have failed to meet performance measures. Those two things are required to be submitted to the report to the legislature this year, and they've been sent to the chairs of the committees. And they're just now in the process of starting to form these work groups, which are also specified in the law, to look at how do we frame those performance measures, what measures exist that we can incorporate and hold on to, and then what new measures need to be developed in other program areas. So the emphasis, I also want to say, even though the language speaks to performance measurement, I think the department and counties in this work group have really taken an approach of performance improvement. How do we really look at where we are right now and use that as a way of trying to figure out where we need to go in the future to improve our performance? And how do we do that within the limits of the resources that we have available? How do we also look at what kinds of requirements exist that may need to be removed if we don't have the resources to achieve them? So we really appreciate the work that DHS has done with working with counties on this, and we feel like that's off to a really good start. Second, the State County Results Accountability Council, that's the other organization that was formed, that consists of legislators, county representatives, and Department of Human Services representatives, and both Representative Abler and Representative Loeffler are on that group. It's just had one organizing meeting. It's trying to figure out how are we really going to organize ourselves to receive these proposals from the counties. So they're just sort of getting started. Counties have had many conversations over the summer and fall about if we wanted to form an SDA, what would that look like? Would it be which counties would be involved? Would it be a joint powers? Would it be a contractual arrangement? Would it be some or all services? So there's been a lot of discussions happening on that, and I think once these parameters are laid out for what the service delivery authority process looks like, you'll see several counties coming forward to want to do that. I also just wanted to mention that I think next on the agenda you'll be looking at a bill from Representative Liebling that has a chemical dependency pilot, and that's really a good microcosm of the kind of thing that we're thinking about here, is how can counties join together, look at how to organize themselves and maybe seek waivers from state law to perform a service or a group of services in a way that might better achieve outcomes. So the ask for you, I'm just going to give this to you generally, and then I'm going to ask Eric Ratzman to provide more detail on the bill. The bill passed last year, and some of you are on the conference committee. It was a little bit of a convoluted discussion. It ended up as part of the omnibus bill, and frankly, we're not expecting that bill to remain in effect, so I think we had thought that we would be doing a little more work on it. As a result, we think that we need some language changes to make it possible to implement the intent of the law, and DHS has indicated to us that that would be helpful too. In particular, and Eric will get into more detail on this, we need to clarify that counties can form these service delivery authorities prior to all of the performance measures being established, because that would delay this process by 3 years if we didn't have that in effect. So we worked with the department on language. The department supports this bill and feels like the changes that they have worked on with us are necessary in order for this to move forward. So now I guess we'll tell you what they are, those changes.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Ratzman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Ratzman with the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. As Patricia mentioned, we've identified some problems in the law that we feel like we need to address in order for the counties to move forward in implementing this legislation. And the bill you have before you is the product of a lot of work we've done with the Department of Human Services on this bill. So we have two main concerns we want to address with this bill. First is that the law as it's currently written is somewhat confusing and contradictory and contains a lot of duplicative language that we feel like this is a good opportunity to make changes to clean that up. And then the second issue is that the law is being interpreted to require that statewide performance measures be enacted prior to counties being able to move forward in establishing service delivery authorities. And from our perspective, we really want to see that process begin now, so we feel like we really need to get a change in the law to make that happen. So you'll see a lot of changes in the bill. I would characterize them mainly as technical, with the exception of the four or five pieces I'm just going to walk us through, which are a little more substantial. First, in Section 3, Subdivision 1 of the bill, we are adding language here clarifying that the Performance Steering Committee shall incorporate federal performance standards when making its recommendations on performance measures. I believe we were operating under the assumption that the committee would do this, but we just want to make it clear in the law that this is going to happen so that we're not jeopardizing future future federal funding with these projects. Additionally, in Section 5, Subdivision 3, we are adding language asking the Redesign Council to make a recommendation to the Office of the Legislative Auditor to really examine the redesign, and we're asking that they do that in 2014 so we can take a look at what's working, what's not working with this process. In Section 6, Subdivision 1B, this is where we're going to make the changes to address the issue of counties not being able to form service delivery authorities prior to the enactment of the performance measures. We really want to make it clear that counties can move forward upon enactment of these changes. Next, in Section 6, Subdivision 3, we're setting out a clear process here for counties to establish service delivery authorities. The law as currently written is somewhat confusing as to what the process is, where the county takes their proposals, and who looks at it first. So here the language is setting up a real streamlined, simplified process to make that happen. And then finally, in Section 6, Subdivision 4, we're clarifying the ability of the Commissioner of Human Services to be able to grant waivers or seek waivers from federal law for the purposes of this law. Want to be clear that we are not creating new authority for the Commissioner of Human Services here. He has this authority under 256. We're just merely tying that authority into this law. And with that, we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Ratzman or Representative Thiessen, would this be a good time to discuss the amendment? And maybe
sure.
Get that.
Yeah, get that. I will move the A1 amendment.
Okay.
And what the amendment does is, many of the employees working for counties are in collective bargaining units, are represented, and what the amendment is intending to do is to say that if they go to work not for a specific county but for a human service delivery authority, that they'll continue to be a representative and continue on in their collective bargaining unit. They'll be represented in a union. And so that's the intent of the amendment. And I think we should have the counties testify first, and then there's others that want to testify to this point.
Right. Testimony to the amendment. Are we talking about?
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
I think I'm going to ask, we actually have a real live human services director here today, Kelly Harder, who's the MAXA legislative co-chair from Steele County. And since he is actually involved in, I guess, union discussions and such, I'd like him to respond to that, if that's all right.
Okay, sure. Mr. Harder, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee. Kelly Harder, human service director in Steele County down in southeast Minnesota. We hadn't seen this amendment. We have been part of the redesign. Our request would be to hold off on the amendment and that we would be able to have some conversation. Because when we look at redesign and the way at which we are looking at, we want to maximize technology. We want to maximize all of the tools that are available to us. And to be, we're not anti-looking at, and we work with our bargaining units. I'm in a bargaining unit in our county, and it works very well. To have legislation that hamstrings us to the purity and the full potential of the redesign, we'd like to have further conversation with the bargaining units at this time before we actually put it into an amendment onto the legislation would be the request at this time. We're willing to have that conversation, would like to have it. We hadn't seen it up until this moment. I'm concerned about it getting attached to this bill.
Okay, we have a couple of people who would like to testify, I understand, to the amendment. Serena Virkin.
Regine.
And Sarah?
Leverance.
Okay, welcome.
It's spelled right on the thing. It's just hard to pronounce.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, and committee members. I thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Serena Virgin. I'm a staff member of AFSCME Council 65. I currently represent public employees of many bargaining locals out in West Central and Southwestern Minnesota. I'm here today in support of sensible redesign alternatives. It's clear that the current system is unsustainable and that delivery methods must be closely analyzed for efficiency, effectiveness, and affordability. I have personally experienced the benefits of redesign services. Prior to my AFSCME life, I was a health inspector for Countryside Public Health. Countryside operates under a joint powers agreement to provide public health programs to Big Stone, Chippewa, Lac La Parle, Swift, and Yellow Medicine counties. They determined years ago that the best way to serve their citizens was to collaborate. While I was busy condemning garbage houses and inspecting restaurants and water testing across the five counties, other public health nurses were performing the dozens of other programs that fall under public health jurisdiction. While presenting information and gaining policy consensus from five separate county boards was an exercise in patience, it was a manageable challenge and ensured that all residents were well represented. Since working with AFSCME, I've had the opportunity to represent the employees of Lincoln Lyon Murray Human Services and Lincoln Lyon Murray Pipestone Public Health. They too recognize the need for a design decades ago to ensure service delivery as a dwindling population spread out over several counties. I've also witnessed when redesign was not completely thought through prior to implementation. A few years ago, when the court services were transferred from county to state oversight, for example. In addition to some inadequate funding for the transition, it has resulted in a duplication of administrative services such as payroll and human resources at the county, district, and state levels. They are now in the process of being addressed. While the initial intent was sincere, it does not appear the quality of services and increased access to justice has yet been achieved. Currently, in my region, the health service directors in Region 6 have been meeting on their own to look at some redesign options. Again, I think they noticed that this was their opportunity to be proactive instead of reactive, and that if they could come up with solutions that worked for their situations, that was better than having to live with what may be imposed. I can tell you that the governor's recommendation from last year of 15 human service authorities scared many of us living out in greater Minnesota. We can't get people to drive 30 miles to get services from their county seats. The thought of them having to travel in excess of 100 to 150 miles to get those services was felt to be unreasonable. I'm disappointed that word on the street is that unions would oppose any and all redesign ideas proposed, or that we're somehow attempting to hijack the process. I assure you I'm not a terrorist. And I think that talk fuels the assumption that labor management relations are by their nature contentious or adversarial. I'm very pleased to say that in my experience, that's the exception, not the rule. The last few years have been difficult for all public entities as they've dealt with the impacts of funding cuts, budget reductions, and program changes. My members have come together with their employers to have positive problem solving. This has occurred because the employees have been provided information, allowed input, and become engaged in the process. It seems that allows them to feel some ownership in the outcome. And while the decisions made are often difficult, they're better dealt with when there's an understanding of why and how they were made. I'm asking you to please allow us to be a part of the process. We would like to be a non-voting member on the Redesign Council that was previously discussed with Representatives Abler and Leffler. Do not look at us as being a threat or barrier, but as a partner with insights from the front line of service delivery. We ask that redesign recommendations fulfill the goal of efficiency and access to services, along with measurable, obtainable outcomes. We support the amendment to continue to recognize the employees of service delivery authorities as public employees under collective bargaining agreements. The amendment language will ensure that no mechanism exists solely to void union contracts or supersede PELRA. Again, it is certain that your redesign efforts will be a template applied to many areas of government outside of human services, and I thank you for your continued efforts on this committee.
Thank you. Questions for me? Okay, seeing none for the moment.
Madam Chair, I'm Sarah Leverins, the Legislative Coordinator for AFSCME Council 65, and we would beg your consideration of our amendment requiring the employees who belong to unions will continue to do so when the service delivery authority is formed, with their wages and benefits continuing under the old union contracts until a new contract is negotiated. I did the initial draft of this language, and I tried, I admit somewhat inartfully, I tried to pattern the language after the language in PELRA about the state takeover of the courts, which allowed the unions in the situation of the state takeover of the courts to continue to exist. And they have a joint contract, the different unions, and they continue to negotiate in that way. Their unions were maintained, and ultimately, as I said, new contracts were negotiated. We are very concerned that some counties see service delivery authorities as a way to create a new employer and get rid of their unions. Several documents, public documents, on one merger mention unions as a problem or obstacle. The Association of Minnesota Counties redesign proposal negatively references unions. You heard the association testify, and essentially I think their position is that we will hamstring them. No, what we want to do is protect the rights of our members. We don't want to leave whether their union in their new employer up to the merged organization. These employees have voted to be union, and we want them to continue to have those rights to protect them in what will obviously be a tumultuous transition as they are changed in their employer and perhaps their duties. We are not, as my colleague, opposed to mergers. If anything, there's nobody who understands better what the service delivery problems out in rural Minnesota are, particularly in some of the smaller counties. We're for mergers that increase the ability of our members to deliver services. But we do not think the employee should bear all the costs of this. And if they must bear costs, we believe they should continue to have union protection and be able to negotiate how and what costs they bear. Thank you for your attention, and I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for members? Okay, Representative Abler.
Well, hi, just thanks for coming, and I've, Representative Thiessen's had the lead in this, but I've been a fan of this project for quite a while, and I never did like the 15 version, just because how would you chop it up into 15, and I see this as being a very innovative way to go about it. And my reward for helping was I got put on the council, so you want to be careful how you help.
We want to be on too, by the way. That's in the amendment. We'll join you.
Oh, okay. Well, there's some extra chairs there, so I don't see a problem. But as I've, just to encourage you, in the discussions I've had and heard, I've not been part of all these side discussions, but what I saw is a way to focus on service. And you need a certain amount of people to do that. And I never heard mentioned as we were doing this development that there was an effort to ununionize counties or anything like that. So I don't get that. And I do have a question. Are you the author of this amendment?
Well, I think I did part of it, and then I emailed it, and I think they put it into a better format than I would have
I'll
done.
I'll just ask you anyway. Representative. There's a lot of things that go, and so if you remember the first version of the bill that came out last year, and Representative Thiessen had, I don't know how many amendments that it got different, and now it's going to even be better. I just hope we don't get, if you're flexible on how the words look and that helps as the process goes forward to accomplish the end that you want. And there's a thing called a placeholder, and where we send forward an intent from this committee, and this has a few more stops to go. And I hope that all the parties are really friendly to work on all this language to make sure that it accomplishes the goal. Because what you don't want as a county employee, is to have the very county who's trying to serve the people unable to, and unable to protect your job under the old model because they were too tight on some of the language. So I just, I know a lot of the social service directors, and they're interested about the people, and I know you guys are, and so if it goes on today, I hope you just keep that in mind as a friendly encouragement to you all, and so does that help?
Thank you. Representative Gottwald, and then Murphy.
I'm holding mine for the bill, not the amendment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thiessen, I am glad to see the amendment. Even if it needs a little tweaking, because I think what you're attempting to do and what the state is attempting to do on the redesign is really challenging work. And by addressing this issue, I think you're adding some certainty and stability to the participants in a way that will help you and others focus on the real goal. And so I'm really grateful to see the language.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
All right. Representative Thiessen, I think we're ready to vote on your amendment. Representative Thiessen renews his motion for the H3055A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Any other discussion to the bill, members? Oh, Representative Gottwald, did you want to address the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, the only question I had about this bill, and I actually heard it from some people in outstate Minnesota, is the representation on the council, outstate versus the metro area. Could you address that?
No. we specified certain people. We didn't. I don't know if we gave any geographic designation, but I think Ms. Coldwell can maybe address that for you.
Madam Chair, Representative Gottwald, Patricia Coldwell. I think that the legislation requires two legislators from the House, one from each majority-minority, two from the Senate, same thing. And I think it's four DHS, Department of Human Services representatives, and then four county representatives. You're talking about the council now rather than the steering committee, right? Two of them are commissioners, and two of them are human services directors appointed by AMC and MACSA. It does not specify rural and urban that I'm familiar with. However, we did choose to have a rural and an urban person from each body. So that's who we have on there right now. And then there's also an ex officio member from AFSCME and one from Teamsters. Did I leave anybody out? I think that's it. Is that
okay, Representative Gottwald? Anything more?
Okay. The human services directors also have appointed alternates, and those are also rural and non and urban.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, I think we're. Sorry, Representative Gardner.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. This happened to me in tax committee.
Yes.
I am just wondering, maybe AMC can answer this, but is there any interaction here about these state county performance measures and maintenance of effort? I know in the tax committee we had a joint meeting with this committee to try and figure out if there's a way to untangle maintenance of effort. So if we're focusing on outcomes with this kind of effort, what does that mean for maintenance of effort? Because we're all trying to figure out how to right that ship.
Well, Madam Chair, that's the whole point of this, and you can talk even more with Representative Loeffler about that. But that's kind of where this is going, okay. A part of it.
Okay. All right.
We didn't talk about it. So this is a good question.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, I agree with Representative Thiessen. I think that one of the things that has been sort of an axiom of some of our redesign discussions within counties is that counties should be held accountable for outcomes and performance over which they have control, so that once we've identified performance measures, we think that something that's more arbitrary, like a maintenance of effort, that's more of a snapshot in time and based on usually a dollar amount, should be less necessary to assure whether we're getting the job done. So that's where this is going, we hope.
I do want to clarify, we're not going to tax committee, though, with this bill. Okay.
Okay. So, Representative Thiessen, we'll have to overlook Representative Gardner here, then.
Yeah.
We're not going to tax committee. No. Representative Gardner, anything further? You sure now? Okay. All right. Representative Loeffler.
Just to the issue of maintenance of effort, I really don't think they're very related, because maintenance of effort is just some counties are required to spend property tax dollars because they historically have in areas where the state has stepped up with state dollars in communities that never offered that service. So it's really about unequal fiscal burdens, not about unequal performance expectations. To me, the real promise of this is that we're now going to have people focusing on performance outcomes instead of the many, many, many instructional bulletins that are sent out each month to all counties that they all have to focus on, which is more about processing and less about what is the impact.
Representative Gardner.
And if I could just maybe ask this too, if just looking at the language, I'm curious, what are the reasons for a county underperforming? Is it because they're broke and they can't do the work, or they're not doing the work well?
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, they're not meeting the outcome standards. One of the other advantages of this process is that, and it's not in this language necessarily, it may be in the rewritten part, but is that part of the discussion that's going to be had in developing the outcome standards and in having this county-state joint board is that it won't just be a discussion about what the outcome standards are, but about what resources are going to be needed to get to those outcome standards as well. So those discussions will be more linked together. And so the expectations will meet resource expectations in a much more direct way than we've ever talked about them.
Representative Gardner? Okay. All right. Any other? Very welcome. Any other discussion? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Thiessen renews his motion that House File 3055 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the committee. As amended. Let us not forget that. And re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform Technology, and Elections. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Representative Liebling moves that House File 3246 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill really follows very nicely after the last one that we heard, and without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Harder to explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, once again, my name is Kelly Harder. I'm here on behalf of MACSA, Minnesota Association of County Social Service Directors. You're receiving a handout, and that's actually what I'm going to be providing my testimony off of. Just as a brief framework, we were in front of this committee and body last year, at which what was approved and ultimately put into law was a framework to provide a chemical healthcare home redesign. It has taken on many different renditions of topic of what we title it. We've referred to it as the CD pilot, and behavioral healthcare home pilot is what you have in front of you. So we thank you for your support and that we were able to move forward with the concept. What we now are bringing forward in front of you is a technical bill. The bill itself is technical in that through the design, and I want to commend the Department of Human Services and all of the work and resources they've committed to helping bring this to an operational reality. To this point, we've learned, as in the other redesign, there were some nuances and technical pieces within the statute that need to be addressed in order for us to implement. What you have in front of you, just as a visual, what you have is the current chemical healthcare, the Chemical Consolidated Treatment Fund, and the options that we have when someone's eligible are inpatient, outpatient, extended care, and halfway house. And what we have proposed is, outside of that red box, at no added cost, is what's called the Navigator concept. And through the Navigator concept, it drops down and it takes four tools for our counties and our community-based service options and moves them into 10 tools at no added cost. We also look at it as saying right now we're able to track an outcome through the DANES information, which is usage while in treatment, and at the very bottom you can see the added elements that we would like to track under the current cost structure to the effectiveness of this program. To your right up in the corner is also how we've taken the consolidated fund. Aren't just people who just use. You have some folks who will fit into a traditional chemical health care model, which will continue to use. Those who are duly diagnosed, roughly around 60% or more, have both mental health and chemical health. You then have the chronic substance users, and then special needs, someone with a physical disability or other disability who also needs some chemical health care and mental health treatment. In all of this, what we're doing is and with the department that we have worked on with this, is to create an ability to flexibly use the funds and more creatively use the financing. The other piece to the reform on this, the service delivery reform, is the payment reform. And we've agreed to have a model by which counties who are participating in this pilot, which are 10 counties in southeast Minnesota and Washington County, that we would take a capitation dollar amount. We are not going to serve less. We're still adhering to all Rule 31. All eligibles will continue to receive services, but those eligible for this program, we would then get a capitation, and if the costs for this run over what our budget is, the counties assume 100% responsibility and are willing to do that. At the same time, if through this care coordination model, the end result is that there's some resources left within the budget, this bill allows us to carry those dollars forward into the next year and reinvest those in the same service delivery system. So in summary, in specific, in front of House File 3246, there's some language in here that cleans up the time frames of the pilot projects on a start date and the end date. It's clarification around the dates when the program evaluation will be due to the legislature, determining the success or the lack thereof of the program. And it also talks about the ability to roll unspent dollars forward into the next year without it adversely impacting the forecast. Finally, it allows counties and the department an out clause if something transpires that needs to happen, given that there's going to be dollars and finances at risk with this. So with that, I would answer any questions.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Leeling and Mr. Harder, thank you for bringing this forward. I think this is the kind of innovation that we're hoping to see as we move forward, and it's pretty refreshing that we're able to kind of think our way through some of these deep holes that we're in. With that being said, I just have maybe a question and a comment. The question is, on the right-hand side, the traditional CD dual diagnosed and chronic substance abuse box, can you talk a little bit, Mr. Harder, about what type of services you would deliver that would be different for the chronic substance abusers versus the, you know, you don't have to speak to traditional dual diagnosis, I understand that, but what kind of services would you give to the chronic substance abusers?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Harder.
Representative Hayden, thank you. That's an important distinction in that how this project, part of the, to be eligible, you had to have, in the past 2 years, been in two treatment episodes, and thus you would be hitting the system again and most likely entering your third, and thus a chronic population, what we're seeing at the county level, is an individual who has received multiple inpatient treatments and is still struggling. And so the type of services that we know have worked through best practice models such as ACT, the assertive community treatment teams in the mental health system, a lot of the work we have seen showing positive outcomes in our supportive housing initiatives where we have chronic users, and when you stabilize their housing and surround them with supportive services, it may be employment, it may be those family engagement, peer support, and just knowing they're going to be able to have a cup of coffee with someone, believe it or not, is enough to keep them, and that they may use less. They still might be using, but they'll be using less to the point where they're not using detox at $200+ a night for a minimum of a couple nights stay on multiple times throughout the month. Hopefully keeping them out of our jail systems is what the research is showing, and keeping them out of our emergency rooms unnecessarily to receive social attention that we can find other ways that they would get through the emergency room. So on multiple levels, we're proposing service delivery options that are built on models that already have proven that outcome. And once again, increased outcomes we're going to be tracking at no added cost to the state.
Madam Chair.
And then
could you speak to the leveraging that you, I imagine there's some leverage that if you start to use other systems, and you talked about ACT or targeted case management or housing dollars, housing subsidies, can you talk a little bit as to what you leverage when you start to access these other systems with this population?
Mr. Harder.
Madam Chair, Representative Hinn, thank you. If you look at your graph, actually, we could use more distinctive colors, but if you look at the second from your left, second box in traditional mental health services, as well as education and primary care, these are, if you think of them as buckets, okay, what we have are buckets of dollars that are already appropriated, and if we have an individual come in, and it's not uncommon that they have not basically sat still or the system has been able to catch up to them to the point where we now can get a full-fledged mental health diagnosis, they may now be eligible for mental health resources where otherwise they weren't eligible for it. So it's about you come in this door, and instead of staying isolated to just the funding in that area, what we're doing is creating walkways. And if you're in rural Minnesota, we talk about silos, but I'm reminded here in the big city we have to talk about skyscrapers and things. So whether you want to call walkways or siloways or however, it allows us to leverage. So you use only that amount of chemical health dollars, and if there's mental health, you leverage that. You leverage educational. We want to leverage healthcare dollars as we're looking at healthcare homes and care coordination models as well. And so it's as much about investing as in an ability to leverage the dollars as it is to more comprehensively meet the care of the person. And it's all, believe it or not, can be done by giving us the flexibility, and we'll assume the risk but also the benefit at the local level and hold us accountable to that.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. And any further questions for this witness? Representative Abler.
Just a question to the whole picture of it. When the last bill gets fully implemented, is this the kind of thing that won't have to come to the legislature, just that the commissioner could authorize it? Is that right?
This is the very type of that gives us a framework to move this dialogue and redesign, whether it's in child support, income maintenance, any of the other departments, we could have it in that form. It gives us that vehicle, yes.
Yeah, and just to plug the other bill in. And so this is the kind of thinking that goes on, and it's the whole redesign thing at this level. We spend so much money and serve so many people, and this is what we've been trying to get at, so I'm really happy. It's a good bill.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Harder. To the next witness, we all call down Eric Ratzman.
Actually, okay. We're good.
Okay.
We don't need to.
All right.
Health.
Yeah, and we have. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Hello.
Would you please say?
I'm Carol Falkowski, Director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services.
Welcome.
Hello. I wanted to speak just to clarify a couple of things. We've worked with Kelly Harder and the group of counties since last July in putting this proposal together. And I want to clarify just a couple of things. When he talked earlier, just a couple minutes ago, about we're going to do all this with no added cost, we don't know if this is going to save money. That's why it's a pilot project. I just want people to know that going in. That's why you do pilot projects, to see if they will save money. So I can't sit in front of you and say, we've done a fiscal note on this and it's not, it's going to save money. We don't know. That's why it's a pilot project. The second thing I want to say is, will it produce better outcomes? I don't know. That's why we're going to evaluate all these outcomes. That's why it's a pilot project. So I just want to be very clear on that point. And then in response to Representative Hayden's question regarding what kind of other funds are you going to leverage, I think it's important to point out that what this proposes is to use actual consolidated fund dollars to provide these services, not to leverage them or create walkways to them, but actually redirect funds that are designated for addiction treatment in the state to pay under this pilot for things that are on the bottom here, like peer support, rent subsidies, housing support, supported employment. And this really is a departure, and this is really, to me, what makes this a significant pilot. This is uncharted waters. Mm-hmm. It's taking one stream of state public dollars and saying, we're going to let you use it for these other things. So it's not really a leverage. It's taking consolidated fund money. The final thing I want to say is that I can say that I have heard concerns from the field about the advisability of diverting consolidated fund dollars for other purposes at the same time the consolidated funding is up for reduction. And that's really my fourth point. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And I do have one question. How are we doing currently with placement and access to treatment in the state?
Well, it's a challenge in the state because we have a state and federally funded system that is county administered. And in the past year, we have hired a person whose sole responsibility is to go see how the 11 tribes and 87 counties are doing in assuring that people do have access to funds. And we have found some pretty significant roadblocks in some counties for people getting access to treatment. So it's definitely a challenge having a system like this.
Thank you. And Representative Hayden has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the leverage question was that it does appear that some of the consolidated treatment funds might be used in non-traditional ways, I guess is what we're saying, in that, you know, to some, I can see where people would have an issue. I guess the leverage for me comes from that it's been my experience that getting people that are struggling with addiction, some of these non-traditional uses helps them to start the process in getting them the subsidies that they may need. So, for instance, if a person got a small housing subsidy out of the Consolidated Treatment Fund, enough to stabilize them to then either access, say, a housing trust fund from MHFA voucher or a Section 8 voucher or a Shelter Plus Care voucher, which comes from HUD, that could be the bridge to get them the kind of permanent subsidy that they would need to then hopefully stabilize their life. So I do think that there is a departure from the traditional ways in which we use treatment dollars. However, if the pilot is successful, and I recognize that it is, if the pilot is successful in getting people to not come back and access the Consolidated Treatment Fund, then in essence we're saving money and we have leveraged those other streams and pots of money for this very population that continues to recycle and use the Consolidated Treatment Fund, which is being proposed to be reduced by 5%.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, I got that.
Okay. Any other questions for this witness? Members? Representative Liebing, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't really need to say too much here. I mean, thank you for the good questions, Representative Hayden. I think this is a very positive thing. I mean, I'm really excited about it. I really commend everybody involved, you know, the department for their flexibility and really working together. When I carried this bill last session, that was the hope, that we would bring people together to try to solve this problem. And, you know, I think what we're seeing here is that they want to try it, you know, focus on outcomes. Of course, when you pilot things, there's no guarantee. That's why we do a pilot, but that's what we've got to do. We've got to take a little bit of a risk in order to get beyond the place that we're in, and that's what people are really doing, and I really commend them all for it. I'm really happy to see that it's happening. I have great hopes for the pilot.
And we all do. Thank you, Representative Liebing, for bringing this forward. And with that, Representative Liebing renews her motion to move House File 3246 to recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Laura? Representative Broad moves that House File 2901 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. And also moves the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a technical amendment. If we could put that amendment forward to get it in the shape for discussion, that'd be great.
All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, I do have...
Motion prevails.
And Mr. Chairman, I do have one more technical amendment that Mr. Chun actually has. It actually just put some dollar amounts in the legislation. The legislation was introduced before the fiscal analysis was taken care of. If we could just add those now, that'd be great.
Mr. Chun.
Sure. Well, Mr. Chair and members, this would be the amendment. Page 9, line 4, you delete the blank and insert $1,200. Then on page 9, line 22, delete the blank and insert $700. And finally, page 9, line 30, delete the blank and insert $19.
All right. All in favor of that? Does everybody understand the amendment? Okay. All in favor of the amendment, say aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. $700. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. In the debate over reforming our health care system, there seems to be consensus around a variety of things. One of the consensus items is that competition is a good thing, and it actually expands consumer choice and will bring down costs. The bill that's before you today is the governor's proposal for the Health Insurance Choice Act, and it essentially does three main things. The goal of this legislation is to improve choice and improve options, improve access, improve competition in order to lower costs for the folks here in Minnesota, to have cost containment efforts built within this proposal, and also to continue Minnesota's brand, special brand of innovation that I think we all are proud of. Mr. Chairman and members, this legislation, as I said, does three main things. The first component of the legislation will essentially allow for the purchase of insurance across state lines. This is not a wide open door that we're putting forward here today in this legislation. This is a propped open door. This is not just a blanket exemption or a blanket opening of our borders. In order to be able to sell to our consumers or in order to for our folks here in Minnesota to be able to buy a plan, we will be choosing very carefully, we meaning the state of Minnesota and the Department of Commerce, will be choosing very carefully to make sure that the plans are actually equal or similar in terms of the regulatory environment, in terms of the competitive environment, and also in terms of the consumer protections, so that the folks that we care about here in Minnesota are protected, have greater opportunity, and also greater choice along the way. The second part of the bill essentially will create an opportunity for people in other Minnesota health plans, Minnesota health insurance plans, to purchase insurance in a way that we as state employees have as right now through a provider tiering in order to enhance quality and enhance cost access. The governor proposes that we use Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance and provide this tiered system. The system essentially will be a peer grouping system based on data that is forthcoming. And essentially what will happen is two things. One, the enrollees will have an incentive to choose a high-performing health care plan, and they'll be rewarded through waiving of certain copays. And also on the other side, we also have an encouragement for the providers to participate in this system. High-quality, low-cost providers will have a rate bump, and we want to make sure that we're getting as many folks in that realm as possible so that people in Minnesota have access to high-quality care. Low-performing providers will see a reduction. It's a cost-neutral proposal. The third piece of this proposal will essentially create a modern Minnesota Care product for parents within Minnesota Care above 133% of poverty line. It'll essentially use the same Minnesota Care benefit that we have today, and the modern Minnesota Care product will have a combination of it's more like a personal health account. So you'll have a participation or a high deductible portion of it, which would, the numbers we just did through the amendment would be the $1,200. The state share of that would be the $700. And the goal would be to give greater opportunity to make choices for the people in Minnesota Care so they can choose high quality and high performing providers for themselves and their family. The incentive is that, again, there will be some state participation, there will be some waiving of copays, and it really does give, I think, greater control to the people within that health care program in a private market mechanism. So, Mr. Chairman, those are three components. I gave a quick overview. I do have with me here today a number of people from the various departments if there's any specific questions that I can't answer. But I know that we all seek to lower costs for the people of the state. Minnesota has a very high health insurance costs, and we need to start getting our arms around and moving forward policies that can help move us in the right direction. I truly believe believe that a combination of these three could really help the people in Minnesota, whether it's opening up the markets, whether it's ensuring that we're having access to high quality and high lower cost providers, or just simply giving greater control and greater opportunities to make their own choices. I think that those are all great things that we can provide to the people of this state. And Mr. Chairman, with that, I certainly would be available to answer any questions.
Let's do testimony, because that may answer some of the questions people have, and then we can come back and answer questions. So, Mike, Mr. Hickey. Oh, and Mr. Johnson, if you want to come down, too. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest small business group with about 13,000 members statewide, and one of the most affected groups of health care, at least at the state level. Virtually none of our members are self-insured, and so all these state laws and state rules matter in a big way to us. Did want to give some supporting testimony to Article 1 and Article 2 of the bill today. We think we ought to give this plan a try to purchase health insurance from out-state insurers. It'd be interesting to see what kind of savings people would obtain if this legislature was to authorize this, what kind of savings, what kind of experience we have with it. We have made some progress at the state level. Most recently, Blue Cross Blue Shield has really stepped up in a big way and offered a slimmed-down benefit plan under Freedom 123, which has been helpful. It's brought some big savings from people. I don't think the word's out near enough. I don't think enough small business people know about it. We're trying to get the word out. I assume others are. But this would be another tool under this bill to possibly achieve something that people are similar to what people are achieving under the Blue Cross plan. Also, Medica and Health Partners have stepped up and done something with our small employer flexible benefit plan also. But this would be a way to give people another tool, see what they could obtain. I think there's an excellent protection or disclosure provision in Section 5 that would really spell out to the Minnesota consumer just what you're not going to get, how it compares to your current proposal. I think that's a great proposal in Section 5 of Article 1. And these are the kind of things people need to be doing for themselves, but I think it's a wise decision to put that in the bill and provide people as much clarity and protection as we can. I also want to just say a few supportive things regarding extending the flexible benefit plan law to all employers. That's Article 2. As I just mentioned, we're having some success with that. This would open it up, I think, for the most part, to about size of 51 to 250, but who knows, maybe employers larger than that would also try to find some relief and some savings under it. But it would really get at, I think, that second group of people who are not covered under the current flexible benefit law, 51 and up, and how high is up, I don't know. But certainly it would be an option for people to look at trying to achieve some savings. Some people are saving close to 20% under the current Blue Cross flexible benefit plan, so that's very encouraging. So I just wanted to urge you to enact positively on those first two articles, and appreciate the chance to be here today.
Any questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hickey, when somebody gets one of these flexible benefit plans and say they have a plan that doesn't cover, sorry, we can't really see each other here. they have a plan that doesn't cover something that they then need that coverage. Does the state then have to pick it up? You know, I'm having trouble coming up with an example, but if something isn't covered under the plan that they chose, you know, what happens when they need that coverage?
Mr. Chairman, these are group plans, and so to my knowledge, it's going to be the responsibility of the employee. I don't think the state would get involved because they're currently insured unless they went into a traumatically bad financial situation and somehow were seeking state assistance, but they're going to be on a group plan, and due to a decision made, apparently under your scenario, there's going to be some benefit they wanted that is no longer provided, and inevitably that's going to happen to somebody.
Mr. Munster-Ragel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling.
Just say your name for the record, if you could. Yeah, thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Manny Munson-Vergala, Department of Commerce. Existing law that controls the flexible benefit plans that Mr. Kennedy's talking about, there is a disclosure to the consumer ahead of time prior to the purchase of the plan what the plan does not cover relative to existing law. So before they make the purchase decision, they know that the item you're concerned about is not in the plan. We've seen the plans filed. He's talked about 23% savings. The savings we're seeing are somewhere in the 9 to 12% range, depending on the nature of the insured network they have access to, that sort of thing.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess, you know, I can appreciate that these could be cheaper to buy, but, you know, when people buy insurance, they're buying insurance to insure against a risk, and by its nature, risk is something you don't know what's coming. So if they should then need the cover, I'm just trying to get at, does this expose us as a state in any scenario to picking up costs for people who otherwise would be insuring against a risk?
Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would happen. I think the individual would have to bear that responsibility. Representative Liebling, these are generally employer decisions with group plans. You know, we hope there's a lot of input with the employees, but this is an employer decision on a group plan.
And I don't know who would know the answer to this, but are employers offering just these plans now? Or are they offering choices to the employees to get to have a bigger plan and this? I mean, these are basically mandate plans versus no mandate plans, right? I mean, that's kind of the essence of what we're getting at here. So do you know if do employers offer both and let the employee choose, or do they just usually kind of offer one?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know.
I don't know who would know the answer to that.
I don't know what the department's experience is. Clearly, not many people are using these plans. The word's not out. I mean, I hope it gets out. I hope, you know, they become more successful and more utilized. Not many people are using them. People are still using the traditional plans that you're really familiar with, but it is an employer decision to go with the flexible benefit plan, and so that would be the plan for that company.
Okay. Representative Laffin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I may not be totally up to date, but I know there has been a lot of cost shifting from people who are insured onto our public programs, just because if they have a, for example, if they're insured and their insurance only covers one, say, 30-day inpatient treatment for chemical dependency or one hospitalization for something or other, and they still have that continuing problem, I believe that if they met other qualifications, you know, they would qualify for the CD treatment fund, or that they could be court ordered for them to receive treatment, and that has to be provided. And I think there is also some cost shifting that happens just because to other businesses, because I've always been surprised that the majority of personal bankruptcies that involve healthcare costs, that the majority of the people who are in that situation are actually insured. And so whatever their debtors are that are, you know, debt burdens that are relieved in that court, obviously gets cost shifted either onto the unpaid providers as well as any other debtors that they have that the bankruptcy court addresses. And, so I just want to make sure that we understand there is still potential, just as there is in the current market, for some cost shifting.
Representative Lee.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Representative Loeffler. That's exactly the kind of thing I'm concerned about. You know, I kind of remember when we talked about this before, like one of the potential areas of coverage that some of these might leave out would be, for example, psychiatric care. So, you know, if I'm an employee, I'm never going to think, well, I'm going to have a psychiatric illness. You know, let me make sure that I have an employer who covers me against that, you know, so I might think, well, this isn't a problem. I'm never going to, or my child isn't going to have a psychiatric illness. And then lo and behold, that's what you have. And then you don't have your medications covered or something, or you can't get the treatment you need, and suddenly you're, you know, not only untreated, but then unemployed and on GAMC, God forbid, you know, especially now. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I really worry about, whether we're, you know, we're kind of maybe robbing Peter to pay Paul again.
Yeah, Mr. Munson-Vergala.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, current law allows employers to make that decision today. If you're a large employer, you can usually self-insure, and you can design your plan in a way that doesn't require you to offer mental health at all. Federal law just simply says if you do offer mental health, it's got to be comparable to how you take care of physical health. Current state law allows small employers to take advantage of flexible benefits. They don't have to offer mental health parity today. The governor's proposal takes that existing premise, expands it to the individual marketplace and the large commercial marketplace. It doesn't change the existing law with respect to small employers today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think this is a good discussion related to cost shifting, but Representative Loeffler, you've got to keep in mind that that's occurring in the market today, and the best thing we can do is give consumers options so they choose to be insured, and that will help with the cost shifting. Right now, these flexible benefit plans are not used in general, and so you have 25% of the uninsured are actually above 300% of poverty line, and are choosing some of them are choosing not to be insured. What we want to do is give them an opportunity, a choice, so that they choose to be insured, and that will help with some of those cost shifting as well. And so we want to get people covered. Oftentimes the mandates actually push people off the scale of affordability. We want to bring them back on the scale, or back on that scale. We want to bring them back to the realm of being insured, because that will help with the cost shifting for everything and all of us. I appreciate your concern, but I think we've got to try to get those folks back into the insured market in the private market.
Thank you, Mr. Peter. Just for a little more clarity, so we're all on the same page about what the federal mandates are. It was alluded to about the mental health. But could you, you're probably the appropriate person to do it from the agency, if you could clarify us exactly what the federal change was in terms of which part of the market and what size of firms, but also the pregnancy coverage, because those are the two big items in the mandates. And there are also two that have federal components. So if you could clarify for us what will or will not exist in the components of the market for pregnancy coverage and for mental health. That would be
Mr.
helpful.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Bunn, I'll give my best stab, but I think I probably have to drag Mr. Gross down here to help me out here. With respect to mental health parity, as I understand it, it applies to ERISA plans, that if you're writing an ERISA plan and you offer mental health coverage under your ERISA plan, it has to be treated in the same way that physical care would be taken care of. Mr. Gross?
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, my name is John Gross. I'm Director of Health Care Policy for the Department of Commerce. There's a number of federal health care mandates. The most predominant ones would be, like Commissioner Manny was saying, if you have mental health mental health benefits within the policy, then you got to provide mental health parity. You cannot come up with a different annual amount of benefits, a lifetime max, stuff like that. If an employer has 15 or more employees, you have to have maternity benefits. Mm-hmm. There's a federal law that deals with reconstructive surgery following a mastectomy. Mm-hmm. There is a federal law that requires how long the mother stays in the hospital after delivery of the birth of the baby. There's HIPAA laws which deal with portability, going from health plan to health plan. There's federal COBRA laws that deal with when you terminate your employment, stuff like that. And there's obviously anti-discrimination, stuff like that. So in a nutshell, those are the essence of most of your federal mandates.
President Buck, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was fine.
All right.
He's the right guy, though.
Mr. Johnson. Oh.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Committee members, just for background, I have a trade association, and I have the commercial health insurers other than the big three. So just for clarity purposes. And I do have, a unique perspective in briefly speaking about House File 2901 and briefly about House File 3245, Chairman Atkins' bill. But my unique perspective is that I've represented commercial health insurers in Minnesota through the years who have left the Minnesota marketplace. So I'm actually familiar, and there's a lot of history there that's probably not, we don't have the time today, but it is directly relevant in terms of the current market configuration. So I've worked with commercial health insurers and familiar with historically reasons why they are left here, and on a current basis of reasons perhaps why they're not here today. And not all those reasons are addressed necessarily in House File 29001, particularly Articles 1 and 2. So I think from the second thing is that as we look at the marketplace and look at the buyers, and maybe we can just for a second identify the buyers, because I think as Mr. Hickey indicated and everybody on the committee here is aware, we've just had a continual shrinkage of the regulated market, as we call it. In other words, Minnesotans that are actually affected by the red books here behind you. And whatever that number is today, it's small, and it surely has been continued to decrease. So I think as to those buyers, and I think for purposes of this bill, we're talking about small businesses. And when we talk to small businesses, surely one of the consistent messages we get is that those businesses like the choices they have when they're buying their commercial auto and commercial liability and commercial property and all of the other coverages that they're buying. Why? Because they have a lot of choices. They have options. And they believe, and we do, that marketplace competition makes a material difference and a benefit to the bottom line cost. So buyers are not pleased at all, and they can speak for themselves. They have already here today with the current market configuration for the group health. So if the current statutes are not working, then I think obviously the question here today is that can this legislature pass any bills that could have any impact on the marketplace configuration and the number of buyers, sellers in this marketplace? And I think to that the answer is yes. Part of it's here. There's some other reasons that would need to be addressed, and those have been debated in some earlier legislative sessions that again, are not before the committee here today. But from our industry's perspective and the commercial health marketplace, we think that House File 2901 and Articles 1 and 2 get to some of the issues. And I think this flexible benefit plan, there's a history of that here in Minnesota. There is a law on the books. It's repealed in this article. And without getting into the history of that, maybe some others might get into it. And if they do, I'd like to come back up and talk about that, because we have a perspective on perhaps why the law hasn't worked as well as it was intended to work. It was passed some years back. But again, I think as we look forward, I think this whole notion of the interstate health insurance, and there were some earlier hearings where I think you all heard some more details about that from our Commerce Department and Deputy Commissioner Manny Monson-Regala. So without going into that, I think it's important that Minnesota takes steps. And these are the kinds of steps. I think there's more work that needs to be done that's helping to change the landscape to encourage. There's a lot of capable companies out selling commercial health insurance around the country who are not selling in Minnesota. And I think if the question is, can we get more of them here so that Minnesota buyers have, particularly small businesses, have more choices, we think the answer is yes. We think that this is part of it. There's other steps that would need to be taken. Again, they're not before the committee today, but with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just stop at that. And just, again, we want to endorse the efforts, encourage it to move forward. We think it's worth it. If the premise here is that we want more competition, then I think we can. Obviously, the current laws are not doing that, so we need to change the current laws. And so I think these are some steps that we can and should take and be looking at to help impact that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
How many companies do you represent sell in Minnesota?
That I have that are selling?
Yeah.
Oh, half a dozen, Mr. Chairman. It used to be a much considerably bigger number.
And do you know how many companies are in general are selling in Minnesota?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
maybe that's for Mr.
Yeah, well, no, there's lists through the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association of just every licensed company. But I think the key thing is that the key thing is the following: it's not whether or not a company has a license.
No,
lots of companies have licenses, and literally sell a smidgen of business. So they're not really in the market competing. There's scores of those. So when you look at the empty charts, I think are good charts to look at. Just percent of the premium volume. Big number, big number, big number, and then when you hit to number four, it goes to a small number. I mean, it's very dramatic cliff. And then after a couple more insurers, there's another cliff where you'll see a whole sequencing of companies that write point, less than a tenth of a percent of the market. So yeah, so people can comment that there's a lot of companies with licenses, but they are not competing in the market for business.
Mr. Munson-Regala.
Mr. Chair, roughly 80% is written by the top three writers of the fully insured marketplace.
Right. It seems to me kind of, I understand that there's people that have a big percentage and there's some that don't sell at all. But there's a different question about who's actually actively trying to sell. I mean, maybe people aren't choosing their policies.
Right. Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, if I can, I mean, as an example, and there's an issue not in any of these bills, but I'll just comment on it. It's not a new issue. It's been talked about in this room and other rooms. Some of the marketplace realities, when you get concentrated markets, then with that concentration comes marketplace advantages for those companies that have those large market shares. For instance, in the group health insurance, a health insurer with a large market share has the ability to negotiate discounts with hospitals. It is a dramatically different market power than somebody who would try to come in or be in the Minnesota market, and they are not going to be able to negotiate the kind of discount. It goes with the market power, and frankly, with those kinds of discounts, if you don't have it, now you're going to price your product based on including the discounts. And if other carriers or competitors have a much more significant discount, you're just simply not going to be able to put a competitive premium on the street. And I'm confident that is a fair characterization of the Minnesota group health insurance marketplace today. So that's just the reality of the marketplace. And I think when that issue has been debated up at this legislature in earlier years and earlier sessions with earlier bills to try to deal with that exact issue in some of the pricing transparency bills that have been introduced in earlier years. So it is just a reality of the marketplace, Mr. Chairman. So I think there are companies capable, but when the market gets to where it's at, then the reality of that configuration is that it almost locks it in as is. And unless you intervene to change that, it's likely to continue in that manner.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, to that point, because I was going to ask, to what degree is the concentration the fact that it takes a lot of work to build a network of providers and relationships. And, you know, whether you're a small business owner looking to cover yourself, your family, and your employees, or you're an individual looking for a policy, one of your first questions is, can I go to the hospital I want to go to? Can I go to the doctor I want to go to, the specialist I have a relationship with? And to me, that has more to do with the lack of competition than offering 100 new policies that come from outside our borders. I mean, the Department of Commerce approves 1,000 different policies approximately each year. I'm told by small business people that they're overwhelmed at the choice. Actually, they're confused by it, and they wish they had a standardized policy so they could get comparable quotes from company A, B, and C. And so it's hard for me to really understand how just opening up the borders is suddenly going to have the kind of companies, the volume that will come in that will build those networks that you've just described. Or is it the real attraction is that they might get out of some, you know, the healthcare premium tax or MCHA or, you know, what's going to allow them to have that critical mass so that they can compete with the concentration?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, what I was commenting, I was hopefully clear enough or specific enough to say this is part of, not the only solution to deal with, can more companies come in and compete in Minnesota. We had more companies in earlier years who left, and there are some specific reasons why they left, and some earlier laws that Minnesota passed impacted the marketplace. I think that on your question, other issues directly impact. I think you're right. I mean, the notion that to the extent you build up, though, that's part of the equation, but it's not the only part of the equation. Companies have to add up, you know, A, what their claim costs are, you know, what's going to be the price that they have to charge to sell that contract in Minnesota, and it's the totality of the circumstances that are going to determine what that price is. But if you're not competitive in the price that you bring out into the streets, you're not going to sell your policy. And so I think we have had a long sequencing, and we're not unique in Minnesota with the concentration of the marketplace as you look at other states. So but the point is this, is that policymakers around the country and in Washington are focusing specifically on this question, can we change the competition in the marketplace? My sense is that there is quite a lot of sentiment and support, because there's a belief that competition does help lower prices, and I don't think we have to look outside our borders. I could show you the market share charts for Minnesota's workers' compensation market. So there's a market that small employers have to buy under state law. The largest company in the work comp market in Minnesota has 11% of the market. That's the biggest, 11%. And then it goes down from there. That's more typical of the marketplaces that small employers are buying into in Minnesota. Group health is unique. It's uniquely concentrated, and it limits their choices. It is limited. I hear more employers complaining about the lack of choices as opposed to being inundated with choices. And I think that is, they themselves speak to that. So I don't think there's any question about the market concentration. So I think in terms of can you impact it, I believe you can. This in and of itself I don't think is going to do the job. There are other issues that are going to have to be dealt with. If the companies that can come that are selling in other states come here, if they're not competitive on their prices or premiums that they're taking out to customers, they're not going to buy their policies. That's pretty straightforward, and that's probably the way it should be. So we have other issues that are impacting that configuration, as I commented. So other things would need to be dealt with. I think this is part of it. I think as we are looking for ways to encourage companies to come here, you know, we had them and we've lost them, and it is actually hard to get companies back once they've exited a state.
Mr. Munson-Ragala.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I just wanted to clarify one of your concerns. The governor's proposal does require foreign plans to pay premium tax and to be participating in MCHA. And in fact, that's part of the reason why the governor is hoping to get more competition. As Mr. Johnson has indicated, the amount of folks who are subject to the MCHA assessment has shrunk from roughly 40% of the marketplace in 93 to around 27%. We need more folks helping to pay that assessment. I mean, that's part of the reason why he thinks we need more competitors in this marketplace.
So to that point, if we get more competitors, then fewer people are going to self-insure? Is that the theory here? And have we seen that happen anywhere?
Well,
I mean, I guess, is the self-insurance a national trend or is it a state trend?
Mr. Chair, self-insurance, from what we can tell, is a national trend to the extent folks are willing to provide. The trend we're more concerned about is the willingness to drop insurance altogether, and we're seeing that occur too.
And is that a state trend or a national trend?
That appears to be both.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, I mean, and I think you all have seen the charts. The business community in Minnesota has brought it forward regularly. The state imposes costs on those plans that are regulated by the state, and they are considerably higher costs when compared to self-insured plans. So, I mean, part of this is like, you know, this is not complicated economics. If you can go into a box and pay X percent cheaper.
That's my point.
So I'm just saying, but the state does have a control directly over a portion of those costs that end up being higher on the small employers in the state than the ERISA plans. There's nothing we can do about the ERISA law
and that's that
box.
I think we all know that. I think that's the point I'm making, though. If you have more people come in, what makes us think that we'll actually have people buying plans as opposed to this going self-insured, because those are embedded in the situation. I understand the point about dropping coverage entirely, which is a different.
Well, for me, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's. I don't know. We can't do anything about ERISA, but hopefully we can do something about the competition that is in Minnesota in the regulated market. That's kind of what I have viewed as the mission. Trying to increase that competition even with the split between ERISA and the regulated market.
And do we know how costs are in how costs are in states that actually allow more competition? You know, so a place like California probably their insurance demographics probably don't look that much different than Minnesota in terms of concentration, right? I mean, most states actually have fairly highly concentrated markets where there's a couple of big players, right? Whether they're for-profit or non-profit. Is that an accurate assessment?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so do we have any kind of national comparisons that where there's a state that has like 15 smaller plans that look more like our workers' compensation market than it does like health insurance, and how those rates compare to to states that have concentrations? I think that seems to be the relevant measure.
I think, Mr. Chair, you're asking two different questions. One is, are there any marketplaces with less concentrated marketplaces? I don't know the answer to that question, and we'll get back to you on that.
Okay.
The second one is, have we seen evidence that opening up borders for competition result in more competition and lower rates? My understanding is that the governor's proposal is among a number of proposals in other states that are looking at sale across state lines, but so far no state has enacted that proposal.
And I think there's one thing in between that I'm asking is that there probably are states where there's a marketplace for health insurance that looks more like Minnesota's workers' compensation insurance. So even if they're not selling across state lines, you don't have the high concentration in three or four companies, but spread more evenly. And you may probably don't know the answer to that right now necessarily, but that would be actually interesting information if we could get that. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the need for we've spent a lot of time on cost containment, and there's all kinds of ways to try and improve that. But I'm still confused about if we have, say, a county that has one hospital and it's got three clinics and it's got, you know, so many drug stores and whatever, there's a certain amount of money that has to come out of that community to pay for keeping that infrastructure running. And whether those bills are paid to 25 insurance companies or to three, it seems like you have a certain amount of no matter who's doing the negotiating, you know, you got to come to that certain kind of a payroll, and maybe you can drop it down a little bit and you can force some efficiencies in the delivery system. But I'm a little confused as to how I can see where for a particular buyer in the market, they might be able to find somebody who gives them a discount. But then it kind of tends to shift it to someone else who's a buyer in the market to some degree. And so I'm trying to figure out if we have a lot more insurance plans to bid on a small employer's thing, is it going to be kind of like when we had the premium wars in which companies were offering really low buck bids for 1 year, and then employers would get hit with a huge increase the next year because they had to give that discount to someone else down the road? And I mean, I know of people who've had to change health plans when companies played that game, you know, every 2 years, and change providers every 2 years just because of that constant shifting. So I'm just trying to understand if you need to have a certain amount of premium dollars paid to keep the hospital doors open and the clinic doors open and the pharmacies still filling prescriptions, how does this help change that by having more plans in that community?
Anybody?
Well, I think that's, I'll take at least a brief start at that, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think what you're asking is kind of the financing of a hospital, that entity that needs X number of dollars of revenue to operate, and when discounts start entering in, or just reimbursement rates, which government also does reimbursement to services at those, and is there cost shifting going on? Of course there is. And we can, you know, I think you all have looked at that a lot. So I think yours is a hard question to answer given kind of the different reimbursement mechanisms, the different reimbursement rates between the general health, between the government programs, between, you know, major medical, between workers' compensation and no-fault auto. They all reimburse at different levels, and they're all related to each other. You know, where one reimbursement is likely going to impact the reimbursement rate at the other system. So I'm not sure that I can kind of bottom line your question as to how this bill fits into that. I think the answer is what we're thinking on is we want that competition to go at that end of it where the employer actually gets options and the insurers are competing between each other, and that bidding drives down prices. Does that happen in other lines of insurance? Absolutely. I think it's the benefit of that part of the marketplace, as I understand it, that the buyers and a lot of policymakers are hoping to bring into the major medical or group health system. So that fighting up front which is really at a different level kind of than the financing of the institution and what kind of revenue do they need. I don't know that there's a direct correlation between the two, because as you indicated, that marketplace competition, sometimes it heats up a lot and prices really get driven down, but that's really the competitors then. That's the choices that they're making and what they have to do with that over time. Do marketplaces change over time? They do. And sometimes competition heats up and prices get driven down, and you'll see the marketplace in a year or two start to come back up. But frankly, those cycles have gone on in America for many years, as long as insurance has been sold. And I think buyers, they like those when the cycles are trending down, and they don't like it when the cycles kind of turn and start trending up. But it's a different issue, Representative, that I see it than kind of the bottom line finances of a institution or hospital.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say that if the purpose of this is just to lower costs for particular purchasers, small businesses in the market, that's one thing. But I think the platform was a little broader than that. And we've really kind of bought into a model of continuity of care in the medical home, and that's really impossible to maintain when in the whipsawing of the market, you're changing insurer and your insurer changing provider network every other year. And I know people personally who have not been able to get back to the doctor they best related to in 10 years because they've never been in a health plan that ever allowed them to go back to that provider. And I think in a rural community, that's not so much an issue because you don't have as much choice. You don't divide up the provider marketplace quite as finely. But for people in the metro, you know, continuity with a lot of shifting of who's providing it and what network does kind of work against other goals. And so I'm just trying to understand if the goal is for the small business purchaser to have more options and just have competition there, that achieves a smaller goal than overall cost containment across the market.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad. And then Ms. Coleman, why don't you come down?
You know, I think the ultimate goal is to get as many people insured as we possibly can. And I think that this actually moves us in that direction by providing a more open door, not a wide open door, but a more open door to greater choices and greater opportunities and more flexible plans. I believe, and the numbers show, that we will actually get more people actually pulled into the insured market versus being out there as uninsured, which the hospitals then end up having to deal with, and the cost shifting occurs anyway. So I do think that is a big and a broader goal. But this also is about giving consumers greater choice and greater control over their health care. And I think also that greater choice and greater control leads to better decisions. And, you know, we got to at some point trust consumers. We want to have the consumer protections in place to make sure that they're protected. But we do have to trust them to know what's right for them and what's right for their families. And this does give that opportunity, a greater opportunity for consumers to make those decisions for themselves. I don't think it's up for us in this room to have a sense of distrust for people being able to make those calls. I believe they can. I believe they should. And I believe it actually advantages all of us if they do.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danette Coleman. I represent Medica. Today I'm here representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, which includes 7 nonprofit health plans. First, I would like to thank Representative Broad and staff from the Department of Commerce and the Governor's Office, all who have been gracious with their time with me in having conversations about this bill. And one of the things I want to clarify, because we're talking about group policies here, but as the bill is drafted, this actually only applies to the individual market. So I just and from my conversations with Commerce and with the Governor's Office, the intent is it for to apply broader than that, but as it's drafted, it really does only apply. It implies that it only applies to the individual market. So I'm going to kind of set that aside. So my comments are mostly about the individual market. But as was explained, Article 1 is what allows the individuals to purchase health coverage from insurers who are not licensed in the state. And the premise here, as you have been discussing, is that this will drive down premiums. And a couple things I want to say about competition among health insurers. Absolutely, we need to have competition among health insurers. Competition among health insurers puts downward pressure on pricing. It forces health plans to come up with innovative product designs. It creates competition in health management programs, which are intended to drive down health care costs. improve customer service and creates innovative tools in the market on provider cost and quality transparency. So I am not about to sit up here and say competition among health insurers is not necessary. The piece of this legislation that we have the biggest concerns on is it doesn't create a level playing field among domiciled plans and foreign plans it's referred to. And in conversations that the Department of Commerce had with individual plans before this legislation was introduced, they went around and spoke to all of the health plans and acknowledged that a level playing field was important to them. And so I was a little bit surprised in looking at the bill. If you look on lines 3.18 through 3.22 of the bill, this is where it provides foreign insurers an exemption for complying with Minnesota law, specifically 62A, 62E, and 62Q. Now, this represents hundreds of pages of legislation that this legislature and legislatures before it deemed to be important pieces of protections for Minnesotans. I'm going to identify just a couple of them that are included in that. So, first of all, minimum loss ratio requirements. Minnesota law requires health plans to have minimum loss ratios, which means that for all of the premiums that we collect, a certain percentage of those premiums have to go back out to pay for health care. There are only 12 states that require minimum loss ratio requirements in the individual market. Again, my comments are limited to the individual market here. And four of them have minimum loss ratios that are lower than Minnesota's. Rate setting. 62A requires health plans to abide by limitations on premium rate increases. 32 states, including Wisconsin, does not include such limitations. Minnesota has a thorough and robust process through which it approves premium increases, including a requirement that insurers back their proposed rate increases with actuarially sound documentation. Some states do not even require that rates are approved before they can be used. I don't think I need to mention the problems that we're seeing out of California with rates of 25 to 39% increases in the individual market. This is an example, and Minnesota has a very robust process. The Department of Commerce does an excellent job in reviewing rate increases, and they have to be approved before they can be used. Additionally, many states allow insurers to gender rate. So you can set rates. If you're a female, in your certain years of your life, you'll pay more than males will. Minnesota does not allow that. Other states do. Just a couple more here. Pre-existing conditions. In Minnesota, individual policies are limited in how far back they can look to determine whether or not somebody has a pre-existing condition. And they're limited in how far into the future they can deny that services for that condition. 40 states have pre-existing condition laws that are less stringent than Minnesota. So, and with regard to MCHA, while this bill specifically requires that insurers pay into the high-risk pool into MCHA, it specifically says individual policies. So this policy does apply to group plans. I'm a little concerned because according to this, they wouldn't have to pay into the high-risk pool. But it doesn't require that those companies, if they deny somebody in underwriting in the individual market, it doesn't require that they tell them about the right to go into the high-risk pool. We all take that for granted because, you know, we sit here and we go through these days. The public doesn't know that they have an option to have coverage through a state high-risk pool. The other things, the complaints, appeals, external review processes, continuity of care, which Representative Loeffler, you mentioned, that would not be required. Access and availability. In Minnesota, a health plan has to have an adequate network so that nobody would ever have to travel more than 30 miles or minutes to receive primary care, 60 miles or minutes to receive specialty care. That's really important in the rural areas of the state where there are fewer providers and they are further apart. There's also provider contracting laws that have been passed that require health plans to pay claims in a timely basis and prohibits unilateral terms in contracts for health insurers. They would not have to comply with this. So that's just a partial list. Now, I do want to make sure that these, according to this legislation, these plans would have to comply with the laws that apply to these areas within their state. So their state may have laws. So I don't want to leave the impression that they don't have to do any of these things. However, from a business standpoint, if I am going to try to move into a market, I'm going to move into a market to a more regulated environment where I would believe I'd have a competitive advantage over the domiciled state. So I think you're naturally going to attract that. You'll also notice that I didn't make any comments about mandates that do not have to be complied with because Article 2 does allow existing Minnesota plans to offer mandate-free products. However, I do question whether we want to incent a race to the bottom with regard to the benefits that we offer in this state. So in addition to the concerns that I've identified, I would like to speak briefly to the premise that more insurers will result in lower premiums, and I think that you've been having that conversation. And so maybe I will just kind of put this in an economic term to think about. So if you remember back to your high school, college days in economics, some of us took more than others. Some of us probably got better grades than others. I got a D in my college macroeconomics. But competition among suppliers drives down prices, whereas too many purchasers can drive up prices. And so when you view insurance companies as the supplier of health insurance, it absolutely makes sense that more competition would drive down these premiums. But when you view insurers as purchasers of health care, which is really one of the most primary things that we do, is purchase health care on behalf of our customers, that could more competition will result in higher premium. And I think there was a question asked, Chair Thiessen, about do we know about other markets that have more insurers? And we actually do. There have been a number of studies that have been done by the GAO, by Milliman and others, looking at Milwaukee. And Milwaukee is a state that has much higher insurance prices than other similarly situated cities. And so there have been a number of requests to take a look at that. And here's a quote from this was the 2006 Milliman study. The lower priced markets included in the study have payers that have the ability to exert significant downward pressure on negotiated commercial prices. Milwaukee's payers generally had smaller market shares and thus less price negotiations leverage than found in most of the study cities. So, and this is actually what Mr. Johnson was speaking of as well, that one of the difficulties for providers to or other insurers to come into this market is they can't get the same discounts. Don't forget, our customers like our discounts. It is what keeps premium increases premiums from being higher that they are. I'd also like to ask a little bit to what Mr. Johnson was speaking of is what is the problem that we're solving? So according to the 2008 Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association assessment, which was referenced, 200 companies paid into the MCHA assessment in 2008. Now, again, as Mr. Johnson said, this does not mean that there are 200 insurers actively selling insurance in the state of Minnesota, but they are licensed. And so if they're not actively pursuing market share in Minnesota, then that's the question we should be asking, is why aren't they? Something that has not been brought up that I am going to assert here is that many insurers choose not to go after market share because the Minnesota environment is a nonprofit environment that does not fit the for-profit business model. So it is a common misperception that for-profits are not in the state because our law does not allow them to be. It is only HMOs that are required to be nonprofit. Insurance companies, which by the way make up over 75% of the fully insured market, do not have to be nonprofit. And Minnesota health plans budget for a margin or profit, whatever you want to call it, of 2%. For-profit publicly traded insurance companies, this does not fit their business model. A 2% margin is not enough for them to get into a market. So this simply is not a profitable market for many insurers. And also, I have here that I'll just put out, this is a report from the Department of Commerce that was done a couple years ago in the early 2000s asking insurance companies why they left the market. And I'll just put this here for the page to send around, but you'll see many of them cited they couldn't make a profit in this market, and that was the reason that they left. So I think the increase in insurance premiums is a symptom of rising health care costs. So while I absolutely understand the need to have competition in the insurance market for the reasons I spoke of, there's a balance that we need to have. And we should, as much as we're talking about competition in the insurance market, we need to be talking about competition in the provider market as well. There have been many studies, the Department of Massachusetts, California, just in the last couple of weeks have had studies coming out showing that provider consolidation has a significant factor of premium increases in those states. I would like to just mention a couple of the other articles. that are included in this bill quickly. Article 3 on tiering, absolutely support tiering. We did a lot of work in 2008. The legislature passed legislation for provider peer grouping that would start to look at the cost and quality of providers. Many of the health plans have products that are based on tiered programs. We think they're very important. But you have to remember that in order for tiering to work, there has to be market incentives for tiering to work. So first, providers must have a financial incentive to attract more patients. And second, enrollees must have the financial incentive to change providers if their provider is not deemed to be efficient, that being a measure of cost and quality. So in government programs, neither of these incentives exist. Providers are paid less than the cost to provide care to people with government programs. The last thing a provider wants to be is considered the best tier in government programs and attract more patients who are going to bring you underfunded reimbursement. And because of CMS laws, we can't have copay differentials, and so we're not able to use that financial incentive from the consumers to choose different providers, because that's how it's effective in the private market, is you pay more if you want to go see a provider who is not considered in that top tier. And I know we've gone long, so I will stop there, actually. The last thing I would say, actually, on Article 4 in the Minnesota Care Modern Benefit Plan, I think we absolutely have to be looking at fiscally sound alternatives. We have to be finding ways to provide coverage. I think Representative Broad actually didn't use the term health savings account, used personal account, which is probably a better approach to it. The concern I would have with the health savings account is that's an individual's money. They could take it with them. It's front-loaded. That would cost the state more money, unless it's a health reimbursement account, which is funded as the services are needed. And plus, when we're talking about people who are at such economic disadvantages, I don't think we want to be giving them financial incentives that say, here's an HSA. If you don't use health care, it's your money to keep. If you use the health care, sorry, you can't use that money for your family. But I think if we're going to call this something other than an HSA, there might be some workable solutions there.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, actually the bill does not allow that money to roll into being the dollars of that enrollee. The bill actually states that the dollars can roll over into the next year, but it doesn't move with that enrollee if the enrollee should move off the program. And so it is more of a personal health health account than it is a traditional health savings account, because the dollars don't just fly out the door.
And just
another clarification, Mr. Chairman, on the peer grouping or the tiering, is that there are the incentives actually in the language of the bill, both for the provider and the enrollee. On the enrollee side of things, the incentives essentially are the waiving of the pharmaceutical copays, and on the provider side of things, it actually is a rate increase for those high performing providers. And so while we know our reimbursement rates are low, this actually is one of those mechanisms that could get some of the high performers the dollars that I think they desperately need.
Yeah, and I guess the questions... First of all, did you say something about CMS rules don't allow variation in premiums?
Well,
cost, I mean?
Mr. Chair, you're limited in on the Medicaid programs with women and children in cost sharing. So there are some populations that are on our government programs that can have limited copays, and there are some that cannot.
So, okay, and so on the premium or on the prescription drug thing, then that can only be for males or females that don't have kids.
And okay. Mr. Chairman, and I misspoke earlier in the hearing. The Minnesota Care product is not a waiving of premium or a copay. It's actually a premium reduction for the parents that fall within that product.
Right, and a premium reduction is all right? Under CMS?
Mr. Chair, DHS is in the room, and they are much more equipped to answer that than I am.
Okay. Okay, any questions for the witness, Representative Abler? And so we're going to go about 10 more minutes.
All right.
On this one. I mean, we're going to go longer than that. But
I barely know where to start. I had some questions about Mr. Johnson, but I guess I'll just stick with a thematic thought, since this has been our topic for 5 or 7 years. This is one more approach. I think we're all doomed if we can't do anything, you know. And I think we have to do something, and not just crazy ideas. We passed a bill out of here that was shot in the dark on the single-payer thing, and we moved that on. These ideas, I think, are much more sound than that. But I think you want to remember on this nationwide thing that 40% of the companies are self-insured, and they have nothing to do with Minnesota law, and they come from who knows where. And nobody has died, I think, because they've had a self-insured company. At least maybe they have. I don't know. We'll hear about that. I think we think we're powerless. We hear CMS will allow us to reduce a rate. Ask for a waiver. We have some very clever national people here who are doing some work like this. In the bill it talks about tiering of providers. We don't take any savings for restricting the function of a high cost clinician. I don't know why that's not in the bill. I'm not arguing this bill gets out of here, it'd be lucky probably, but we'll talk about the detail later in the next committee. But we have all kinds of power. And the management of plans, I've been a provider 31 years. I can tell you how little the plans manage anything. In a lot of cases, they mail out checks. And they don't do provider outreach. You know, you got the high-cost patient. We had a cost containment committee. We had all kinds of ideas. And everything just can't work because it affects somebody's market share. And I'm nervous at the end of the day here that we're going to do nothing and wait for some federal thing to come and fearfully make it worse if they do. From what I see, some of this stuff, and add more people to Medicaid, which will even more collapse the system. You know, in the mandate thing, I have voted for almost every mandate you ever could have had, but I realize I've lost the fight, and the chamber people know that, and the witness at the table knows that too. But we've lost the fight on mandates. Only 27% of our companies are subject to those. I've lost. If you care about getting something fixed that you're saying they have to fix, we can't do it anymore except for a small subset of people. And so, just to point out, we allow the bulk of our work to be done decided in Washington by Medicare and by the ERISA people, which is just some fuzzy law that they can do almost anything. And I'm just amazed at the pushback on some of these ideas. I think this bill, like the Bly bill, needs a bunch of work, but I think it's got some merits. I think the Minnesota plan about, you know, some changes in Minnesota care where it goes, we're going from $400 million to $800 million in 5 years. And the governor suggested we kick out a bunch of people. Not my idea, but if we don't, we're going to have to. And we had better be creative in this world of ours. And I would urge the committee to vote this bill out, and with or without recommendation to the next level, and try to find us something we can agree on. The world is ending. And I'm just, I guess it's a rhetorical question. I'm not even going to ask a question, but I'll leave it at that. But in terms of health costs consuming a bigger part of our budget, I didn't know I made a joke. The health part of our budget is consuming us. And businesses are unable to keep insuring their people in a time when we hear the forecast that came out yesterday that said jobs are going to be flat till 2013 and the wages are going to be flat till 2011. There is no more slack in the world, and we had better ungridlock our thinking in a bipartisan way for just pure work to save the companies that we assert we're here to help. So that's not a question. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have an answer to the waiver or to the question, Mr. Chairman. The department.
Well, thank you.
And I have to say, I had this information. They did a good job giving it to me earlier, and I forgot about it. But yeah, the tiering will actually require a waiver. But I think, Mr. Chairman, that's why it makes things like this so important, because Minnesota has been an innovator in so many ways. We've done things different. We've been unique. We've been high quality, low cost for so long. And my fear is if we do punt to the federal level, we will have to get more and more waivers. We will it'll slow our ability to be innovative, which we always have on a bipartisan basis in this state. And so that's why I feel so strongly that state options, state solutions are actually the way we need to go, and why I was very pleased to be able to carry this legislation forward here today. You know, whether it's selling across or purchasing across state lines, because, Mr. Chairman and members, you'll notice that we're talking about purchasing because we're talking about people. We're talking about consumers. We're not talking about the industry itself. We want people to have those choices and have those opportunities. And so I do truly believe that some sort of across state lines action will occur. My preference is that we're in the driver's seat, not the feds.
We actually do have one more testifier, but Representative Rood, you can ask your question while Ms. Kimball comes to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rudd, for bringing this forward. This is, you know, we're all grappling with what we can do about providing health care for people. I am part of the Small Business Caucus, as is Representative Rudd and Representative Norton. We had an excellent caucus a couple weeks ago about this very issue, and some of the comments that were made in the caucus that we heard from some of the testifiers, some of I think are in the audience here today, conflict a little bit with some of the information you've been sharing with us. So I just think it's good that we continue to have this discussion. I'm glad we're having it. Ms. Coleman mentioned something that I guess is a concern to me and mentioned the issue of a playing field that's not level. And in particular, in section, let's see, subdivision, it's on page 6, I'm not sure, and it's subdivision 3, and it refers to 363A, which is the Human Rights Act, which is the last line of which is, it is also the public policy of the state to protect all persons from wholly unfounded charges of discrimination. So I guess I have concerns about that, and I know the gentleman from the Commerce Department mentioned that there were some federal mandates that we have to comply with as far as discrimination, and this one concerns me a great deal, especially I guess with gender rating, and I don't know if you want to speak to that.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll have Department of Commerce come down and talk about that specific plan. Keep in mind, Representative Rood, that these flexible benefit plans are, again, right now only available to 26.8% of the folks out there. And so we're talking about a small group of people that we can even impact. So the goal of this legislation is not to sidestep the important consumer protections and the important protections that you're pointing out. And so maybe they'll talk about the specifics of that. But, you know, it's really meant to include those consumer protections and also the regulatory environment that is very similar. Only allow states to actually people to purchase from entities in states that actually have a similar regulatory environment, a similar consumer protection, and other similar laws that we would expect here in the state of Minnesota.
Ms. Kimball, why don't you go ahead, brother?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that provision is from the existing flexible benefits law. We just pull it over into the new version. The concept here is to require, to basically say that the federal law, the 17 mandates that Mr. Gross talked about, are still in place. So that's just the intent. It's what's currently there already.
But it would allow you to distinguish between men and women, basically. I mean, that's, I understand it's current law. Well, why are we getting rid of 363A then?
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Gross again. What 363A is a state law requiring an employer to provide mental health benefits. When this state law was created for the flexibility for the small employers, they wanted to take that out.
So that's not the Human Rights Act?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't quite.
That's not the Human Rights Act?
That is. And that requires an employer to provide mental health or maternity benefits. That's a state law. But we can never be exempt from the federal law that requires if the employer has 15 or more employees, you still must provide maternity benefits. So we're exempting from the state human rights law on maternity, but we're still subject to the federal one.
So not mental health, but maternity. You said mental health earlier.
It's not mental health, it's maternity, pardon me.
Okay. Ms. Kimball.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. AARP members, especially those aged 50 to 64, are very concerned about finding affordable health care coverage and maintaining strong consumer protections now available to Minnesota residents. First, let me just begin by saying that AARP is very supportive of efforts at the national level to reform our broken healthcare system. We believe that Congress must act now to make healthcare more affordable, to provide good coverage for those who do not have access, and to include consumer protections every step of the way. To that end, I do want to commend Representative Broad for working to make health insurance more affordable and accessible to consumers here in Minnesota. However, we do have strong concerns about House File 2901 because we believe it does lack strong consumer protections and appropriate oversight at this time. And we believe it would permit the sale of policies to Minnesotans that could provide inferior coverage and benefits. The savings generated from interstate sales would benefit only some residents and only temporarily. If the foreign state allows the insurance company to reject applicants based on medical history or to charge higher premiums based on age or gender, only those who are young and healthy would be accepted. The population might realize some savings, but these would likely disappear when they grow older or they need additional medical care. This proposal could potentially lead to insurers from other states restricting consumers to a very limited and inadequate network of low-quality health care providers. Individuals who purchase low-cost, low-benefit policies from other states could potentially be forced to seek uncompensated care from our providers due to inadequate coverage or high out-of-pocket costs. This could result in increased cost shifting and higher premiums for all individuals and employers, including state and municipal governments. Individuals faced with high medical costs, not covered by their out-of-state insurer, could potentially end up on medical assistance. This proposal could mean the loss of long-standing consumer protections currently guaranteed by Minnesota law. Current state law is the result of many years of careful deliberations by the legislature and the Minnesota Department of Commerce and was demanded by consumers. All insurers in Minnesota must provide coverage to individuals and small employer groups that meet our state's minimum standards.
And we do have the written testimony. So if there,
okay.
We're just running short on time. So if there's like specific things we want to hit at a highlight, that would be really helpful.
Absolutely. Let me just say that the major result of interstate sales under this proposal would be to segment the consumer population, leaving many paying for insurance and health care. In-state insurers would be left with a smaller pool of older and less healthy consumers and increase the per capita claims. This could trigger higher premiums and or cuts in benefits, leaving in-state companies less able to compete. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that actually is a question I had in my mind, if there's a selection here, adverse selection involved. So thank you. I am going to just ask one more question and then let Representative Broad wrap up, and that is the administrative uniformity work that we did over the last couple of years. Are the companies that would sell across state lines going to be subject to those rules?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And where is this? How and why? Not why in principle, but what in the legislation would make that the case?
Mr. Chair, if we miss that, and with respect to also the concerns by Ms. Coleman, we're happy to work with folks to clarify the intent, but that was the intent of a governor's proposal. But we can include language in an amendment to clarify that the AUC work is, in fact, part of the equation.
And when you're talking about Ms. Coleman, you're talking about the rate increase work and the gender rating and all those kind of things?
Mr. Chair, I think the governor's direction has been that level playing field is, in fact, something we're going to strive for with the
taxes.
Correct.
Okay. Or C fees or whatever they are, surcharges. Okay. All right. Representative Broad.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I'll just wrap up. You know, it, with all due respect to Ms. Kimball, if you listen to that testimony, it would seem as though we're forcing people to make a certain choice and purchase out of state, and that's just simply not what this bill does. This bill really gives consumers greater opportunities for choice, greater opportunities to find a plan that better suits their needs and better suits their price point and the needs of their families. And so, Mr. Chairman, I truly do have greater opportunities to find a plan that better suits their needs and better suits their price point and the needs of their families. And so, Mr. Chairman, I truly do appreciate the opportunity to both carry the governor's legislation and be here with you today. The three components of this bill are crucial in terms of health care reform. Purchasing across state lines will allow greater choice. The provider tiering will ensure that we're having high quality, low cost care as possible for our state programs. And then the Modern Minnesota Care opportunity, I think, is a reform we shouldn't pass up. We've got to start doing things differently, and this bill would move us in the right direction. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Okay, thank you. And I am going to actually amend your motion and move that this be reported as amended to the Committee on Commerce and Labor without recommendation. So we have to actually have a vote on that amendment to the motion. Is there any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? right. Seeing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion that 2901 be reported as amended to the Committee of Commerce and Labor without further recommendation. All in favor of that motion say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Division has been requested. All those in favor, please raise your hands. All those, I said all those in favor, I meant instead of opposed, but that was in favor, yes. Okay, all those opposed, raise your hand. Okay, so, sorry about that, yes. I hope everybody understood that, right? Okay. Yeah. Your votes were right. So, all right.
They're always
okay. Yeah. 12-5, the motion prevails, and it's passed on. Okay, Representative Atkins, and we've had a long discussion of this issue. So what would be really helpful is how your bill differs, I think, if we want to focus on that from the last discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'll move his bill.
I will move the bill 3245, be recommended to pass and referred to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard. House File 3245 is essentially House File 2901 on the Atkins diet. What we've done is taken literally all of the testimony in favor and all of the testimony against and melded that into this bill. What I have heard is that what folks are looking for is interstate health insurance, the ability to buy health insurance across state lines, for-profit, non-profit, inside of Minnesota, outside of Minnesota, but they want it to comply with Minnesota law. That's what this bill does. This past weekend we had the Canadians and the Americans playing hockey, and the governor's been known to wander down to our district in South St. Paul, play a little hockey down at the Wacota Arena. The last bill that you heard was the equivalent of inviting the Canadians to come on down to the Wacota Arena in South St. Paul and be on the power play the whole time. Invite those folks from outside of Minnesota to come in. They'd have a distinct advantage over folks doing business in here in Minnesota, and they'd bring their own referees with them. Now, Representative Emmer, you got to get that. That's just not a level playing field, let alone the way that a hockey game ought to work. So what we do is we just say that everybody's going to comply with the same rules, they're going to live up to the same expectations, and that Minnesotans will have an ability to count on the fact that folks will have to still, whether they're from Wisconsin or Alabama or Minnesota, that they will comply with Minnesota law and will have the same sort of protections, the MCHA assessments, all of the various requirements that folks like Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and others that have come up here in Medica that have come up here and testified. I would suggest that you think about one thing also, by the way. My focus is on benefiting the consumer, greater competition, driving down prices, but also better quality. Hopefully it enhances quality. But I'd also, from a commerce perspective, and I know this is a health committee, but I know one thing that we're going to take into account when it gets to my committee, if you're so kind as to send it there, is that if you're, let's use Blue Cross Blue Shield for an example, because they're right next door to me in Eagan. They got this big headquarters over there. If you pass the last bill, and I'm Blue Cross Blue Shield, what would I think about doing? I'll tell you, I'd probably think if I was domiciled elsewhere, if I was one of those out-of-state insurance companies that get all of the advantages here in Minnesota, I'd probably think about very hard about moving over to Hudson or someplace else, because then I wouldn't have to comply with Minnesota laws anymore by just going over and being based out of Hudson or some other state find someplace with really low requirements. I could still take advantage of my network and all the various things. I just wouldn't have to comply with Minnesota law anymore. That's the chief commerce reason I think this bill, my bill, House File 3245, is a better approach. And with that, I'd appreciate your support.
Discussion.
Well, thank you. And committee, I appreciate you moving that bill off to the Atkins workshop. I think the more ideas we can consider into the mix, that's really a good thing. I just have a question for the author. And this isn't the Commerce Committee, and I know you haven't done the runs, but Are you aware of anybody who's going to come actually take advantage of the services under the Atkins diet, under this plan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, since it's not law yet and it has a little ways to go, I'm not aware of anybody yet, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, and I'm open to ideas being shipped off, so I think that's a great idea, and I think that if there could be a blend, I kind of agree with some of the author's comments, and I have reservations about some of the bill parts we passed out, but I think that what I was going to ask Mr. Johnson, I know there's another bill coming, want to leave some time for that, but in the auto insurance world, somehow it seems to work. And in the building casualty stuff, somehow it seems to work. And so I hope there's a way that when it gets along the way that the author of this bill and mine's beyond mine can find a way to get some of the benefits out of that and give one more option. And in respect to concerns of AARP and all that, too, I'm all about quality, too. So I urge you to send this bill on its way and let it get crafted.
Holler. Make everybody happy. The only question I have is, what is different if someone is to register or not register? Is there anything different that an insurance company would see whether they act under this bill if they actually signed up in Minnesota versus not signing up in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, if I understand your question, they would actually have to, if they wanted to do business here in Minnesota, they'd have to go through the same process that any other insurer that's currently based in Minnesota, the Blue Cross, Blue Shields, and Medicas, and so forth.
I guess is why then.
In addition, I might add there's one other significant change I should have noted, which is this would allow for-profit folks to also do business in Minnesota. I'd expressly point out lines 3.9 and 3.10, the out-of-state health insurer may be a for-profit or non-profit company. And that's also been an issue that has kind of been pushed under the rug for a while. We haven't necessarily allowed everybody to do business in Minnesota. And I see no reason, particularly to the benefit of the consumer, that we shouldn't have that competition be healthy and vibrant and let anybody that wants to take a shot at selling to consumers here in Minnesota that's willing to comply with Minnesota law have a right to do so.
Okay. And this would apply to all, and your bill applies to all plans, not just individual market, but to the group market as well.
That's, Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. That was my direction of the revised.
Right. Okay. Any further discussion on this bill? All right. Seeing none, I will. Did I move that or just
you did.
All right. I will. I move
but
my motion.
I'm pretty angry about that.
I'll let Huntley move it. President Huntley moves that 3245 be recommended passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill moves on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
What's that?
Steve.
For different reasons.
Yeah.
Hey, whatever.
Representative Gottwald will move that House File 3036 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd also move the A1 amendment.
Representative Gottwald move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape he wants it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to hear this this bill. We've had a few conversations about it on the House floor, and I think it's good that we have this opportunity to go over it. I am not going to plug in a computer or try to do that for the overheads, but you have copies of the 6 slides that we had in our PowerPoint. So in the interest of time, we'll just refer to that. The goal of this bill is to provide affordable health care coverage to those eligible for Minnesota care in a sustainable manner. A very important issue as we look at the financial brick wall, if you will, that's coming at us. And you notice that on the slide, the track headed for the brick wall. We want to take the track to the right on the slide, the one that doesn't have a brick wall on it. It moves us from a defined benefit program offered on a per member per month capitated basis, as we have now, that costs us on average about $600 per member per month, to a defined state subsidy for purchase of private health care coverage. This model not only gives enrollees access to affordable coverage, but it also pays hospitals and other providers commercial rates, dramatically reducing cost-shifting pressures that we know are existing in the market that are driving up the cost of other people with health insurance, and also helping deal with uncompensated care. The bill applies to traditional Minnesota care recipients, not the general assistance medical care population. So this is for people at 133% of the federal poverty guidelines and above, up to 275%. The savings from this approach, however, are intended to help deliver needed care to the general assistance medical care population. Enrollees would receive the subsidy on the scale that's listed in the bill itself for up to 100% of the premium on a private health plan. They would pass through standard underwriting. If they are ineligible for coverage through standard underwriting, they would access the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, and they receive a 20% increase in the state subsidy to help make that happen. In addition, the bill has specific language making MCHA whole from the savings that this bill is expected to drive. And we have requested a fiscal note that is on the way. This isn't a finance committee, I know, but that's an important factor. Last year, the Department of Human Services, when they went through a similar scenario for us on House File 1865, estimated that up to 30% of Minnesota care enrollees would end up in MCHA. And we have used that same number in our considerations as well. The bill also addresses Minnesota care enrollees who have an employer who offers health care coverage. This does happen occasionally, by the way. I know that's a question mark for some people. It does happen occasionally. And the subsidy would apply to the employee's portion of that health coverage. The intent there is to try to match up with the employer and not have a person either end up having to be totally in Minnesota care or totally on their employer's health plan or without coverage at all. Finally, this bill touches on the general assistance medical care population with what I would describe as a place saver. It references utilizing Minnesota's community health clinics for delivery of primary and preventive care to the general assistance medical care population. Mr. Chair and members, we've talked a bit about the fact that the general assistance medical care population needs primary preventive care. They're really not getting it under our current system as well as they should. We have visited with the community health center people, and I believe they'll be up to testify in a little bit. We realize there are a number of details to work out on that, but we think it's an idea that is worthy and germane to this particular bill and will help us deliver better health care coverage to the general assistance medical care population. Quickly, just a few other things that benefit this bill or that this bill provides as a benefit. The removal of a stigma and the increased access. When a person buys a private health care policy under this approach, they're going to be able to walk into a provider on an equal basis with other people who have commercial health care coverage. They're not going to be refused treatment because of low provider reimbursement rates under public programs. They're not going to have the stigma of feeling like, well, I've got to walk in with a membership card to a public program, because the subsidy is invisible to the provider. That subsidy is helping pay the premium for their health care coverage, and they're coming in as a fully covered individual. So there are some side benefits. Minnesota Care, not dramatically, the point in my note here is simply that Minnesota Care, their population, is somewhat more unhealthy, but not extremely. From 133% of federal poverty guideline up to 275%, this population is not dramatically more unhealthy than the standard population, and we'll hear more testimony about that in a minute. So we have looked at this fairly closely, and we believe this model can work for the traditional Minnesota care population. The subsidy, by the way, is combined with what they're currently paying in premiums. So, for example, a family of three on Minnesota care right now might be paying somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 per month in premiums. This subsidy, along with that out-of-pocket expense they're currently paying, and you take that amount into the private market, and you can get very good individual coverage or family coverage. So it's important to note that it's the subsidy plus what they're already paying in premiums that you have to look at as what they have to go to market with. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. John Tyler, if I may.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Tyler. I'm co-owner of Boys and Tyler Financial Group, Incorporated, and member of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters Legislative Committee, and I've been involved in healthcare reform initiatives since 1992, and thank you for hearing my testimony. We're very pleased to introduce this contribution to the discussion to address the healthcare treatment needs of both Minnesota Care enrollees and the General Assistance Medical Care enrollees in the form of House File 3036. We seek to find as many dollars as possible through a defined contribution approach for the Minnesota Care population especially, and fund the medical needs with through that savings for the General Assistance Medical Care population. I think House File 3036 bill may be best described as a cost coordination effort for both Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care. Presently, we are bearing most of the cost of the Minnesota Care enrollees through the Minnesota Care program with some federal subsidies, but by and large, as a state, we're bearing the majority of that cost. Same story on General Assistance Medical Care as well. We as a state are bearing the majority, if not all, of that cost, and it's a significant one. We respectfully suggest that combining efforts with employer-sponsored group and individual employee benefit plans, as well as federal efforts through community health clinics throughout the state, is an approach deserving of your thoughtful consideration. The small employer group market in Minnesota is seeing individuals waiving group coverage in favor of Minnesota Care very regularly. Now, the required 75% minimum participation required of small employers to be part of a group plan can be impaired because individuals are waiving the employer coverage in favor of Minnesota Care, and do account against that 25% figure that would disqualify them for a small group plan. Unfortunately, this is an unintended consequence of the current system, I'm sure, but nonetheless very real in the marketplace. Rather than continue this approach, it does seem plausible, does it not, to consider coordinating with or supplementing what employers are already making available for employees, spouses, and children premiums as well. Employers have no 51% requirement for spouses and children coverage premiums under the current group insurance model at all. In this way, the risk of much of this population is spread throughout the available guaranteed issue employer group plans. What I mean by that is that by providing a premium subsidy to people that have a small group plans or any group plan available to them, it encourages them to enroll in their employer's plan rather than waive it entirely, taking down one of the obstacles to small employers adopting small group plans at all. And so rather than encouraging a model that encourages them to drop their employer plans, we want to design a model that encourages them to participate in their employer's plan. That's a critical component to this, because we do not want to just be in a position of dumping all the adverse risk on the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. That is not where we want to go. We want to spread it evenly among the employer marketplace, not just using MCHA as the only place, to put the higher risk individuals. That's a very real concern, and that's what makes this plan, I think, as strong as it is. In the event employer plans are not available, the defined contribution is substantive enough, combined with what individuals are already paying towards their Minnesota Care, as Representative Gottwald mentioned, to purchase quality individual coverage in the private marketplace that the individual really wants. It's not a matter of saying this is how much you will spend out of pocket. It's a matter of here's a subsidy, go to the marketplace as a whole, purchase what you want for you and your family. If you want maternity coverage, buy a plan with maternity coverage. If you want it without, then buy it without, et cetera. How much the individual actually out of pocket for premiums would be up to the individual, since they may purchase the plan of their choice using the reimbursement schedule outlined in the bill for your consideration. This reimbursement is both income adjusted as well as much as 50% for incomes between 134% and 150% of federal poverty guidelines, and further increased by another 20% if the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association is the plan of last resort. The reimbursement model is also age-adjusted to reflect both the individual and small employer rate bands so that a 50-year-old's higher premium than a 20-year-old will be recognized and compensated for. Our estimates indicate reason for serious optimism for this approach that will provide significant dollars to stabilize both the health care access fund for Minnesota Care enrollees and further providing the much-needed financial support to the community health clinics that will be largely responsible to meet the needs of the General Assistance Medical Care population. So we're trying to find the money to fund GAMC and keep it stable by further complementing and coordinating with the community health plans. There's 76 in the state of Minnesota, not counting the ones available in Superior, serving Duluth, and Fargo, serving Moorhead as well. So again, to help provide funds to help beef that model up and help provide those of you that are single-payer advocates, this is it. this is really providing this type of a model for that population. So they're currently largely supported by federal dollars as well as private sector dollars as well, and we seek to complement what they're doing rather than take the whole burden on our shoulders through the current Minnesota Care or GAMC model. Thank you.
So how does this pay full commercial rates but providing the same services? Where are the savings? Where's the money?
The savings come from a number of places. If you look at the slides in the handout, for example, the private market, instead of sequestering Minnesota Care in one big group and treating their experience separately and doing it through a capitated model, we are putting these people into the private marketplace where the risk is spread across the market. Utilization will be different. We know that from experience. We are also going to a defined contribution as opposed to a defined benefit. So this is an amount of money that is given to somebody to purchase an individual policy. And we found when we went out on the market and looked at what people can purchase that they can get basic coverage, even low deductible. You know, again, you have to look at the amount here, you know, rated for age and then adjusted for income. In addition to what they would be paying under Minnesota Care for premium, you take that amount and you go on the market, and we find they can purchase pretty darn good coverage.
And I guess my question is, why? What is it about Minnesota Care that makes it more expensive in your model?
I wish we could, Mr. Chair, I wish we could answer that question more specifically. We've asked for details on claims data from the Department of Human Services before. They are unable to because that's what the health plans. But we think there are a variety of factors involved. And John, if you want to speak to that too,
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think this isn't saying the present model is inefficient. It's saying we're carrying the entire burden on the backs of the state of Minnesota. What we're really doing with this is we're coordinating the cost with small employers plans that are available dollars that individuals are walking away from because they prefer to be on the Minnesota Care plan. Or the GMC population, they're operating entirely on that the current system as far as the cost is concerned. We are coordinating the cost of that with the federally funded community health clinic. So we are sharing in the cost as opposed to carrying the full weight of the cost on the backs of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Gottwald, I don't see anything in here that says any kind of minimum requirements for the policy that is purchased. And I know it's currently our policy under at least MA, and I thought it was under Minnesota Care, to require us to pay the premiums in employer-based coverage when it's cost-effective. It's not always cost-effective because of the projected cost. So the government cost is actually cheaper than the private cost sometimes. And so I appreciate your acknowledging that as a policy, and we should make sure that we are doing that appropriately. But am I correct that there's no minimum benefits here? Someone could go out and purchase a policy, for example, that under the, you know, that doesn't cover maternity coverage, for example, and the family or the provider then would just be at risk where they present, or they might not cover preventative care, the no shots, no school, they'd have to try and find a free place to go. Is that correct, that any policy, any level of benefits? Because that to me would be the main answer to the question that you raised, Mr. Chairman, which is where's the savings? It's got to be because they're going to be buying less.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I don't think that is a correct answer. The point is this is a very different approach, and these are the paradigm shifts that need to take place as we talk about health care reform. When you go in the private market and you look at benefits, and you look at what you can pay to get those benefits in the private market, we find we can get very similar benefits for less money. That's just part of the answer. I don't know the answer to Representative Thiessen's question because we don't have the details about why on a capitated program that pays $600 per member per month completely out of the state's pocket, we have the kind of expenses we do. We do know that when you spread it across the population in the private market, we are driving similar benefits for less money. Now, the answer to your other question is that people can choose what they need. This is not defined benefit. You're absolutely right. We are not setting minimums or maximums or mandates or anything else. We're saying that these people in Minnesota Care are unable to afford health care or are not being offered it. They need something, and they need access to good basic health care. We found you can get that for these kinds of rates on the private market. Now, if you need maternity coverage, then you get maternity coverage. That's what you do right now if you don't need Minnesota Care. Every other Minnesotan who is not on a public program is making those decisions every day. Okay, so this now treats Minnesota Care recipients as consumers. They can get what they need or want. They get help from the state to make it affordable so they're not going without it. And then they get to choose. And I think that dovetails kind of with the conversation we had in some of the earlier bills. This is creating options and opportunities and a state subsidy to help them afford it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Loffler.
Representative Gottwald, I've always been perplexed by the black box of how DHS sets rates under PMAP, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are a few rate sales where you could actually make that difference. It'd be really helpful if you have examples of current policies that you can show us age, sex, rated, what the PMAP payment is versus for the same benefit set you would have in the provider, the private market, which would be the full, you know, required MA benefit set, because that would really help me understand, you know, is there a gap or isn't it, and which rate cells can you not do that for? Is it, you know, when there's too many, there's people who speak foreign languages and you have to add interpreter benefits, which is not a standard policy in the private sector, or there's, I mean, it'd be nice to know where this is true and we ought to pursue that approach, but also who it isn't true for.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I would point out this is a defined contribution model, and we don't come to the table saying that we are going to mirror Minnesota Care benefits. That's a road we've been going down, and it's unsustainable. But it is not true also that by taking the amount of money we're looking at here and going to the private market that you can't drive very similar benefits, because you can. And we've got examples of it. We have folders up here. Any of the members want additional details, we can hand those out. But there are clear examples in the private marketplace of plans that provide very good benefits. And that's what Minnesota Care was meant to do in the first place. It was designed to provide basic benefits to people who had no other way of getting health care coverage.
And I think that's those folders are what Representative Loffler's looking for.
Right. Sure.
So we
brought them along to whoever would like them.
Right. I mean, I do think we have a public interest in actually having, if we're using public money, that it's actually buying a policy that's meaningful to people. So a $10,000 deductible policy for someone making $30,000 a year, you know, I personally don't think that's a particularly meaningful policy to have. And so, but that's an aside. Representative, well, it's not really an aside. It's a comment. It's not a question. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Gottwald, I think we do need a paradigm shift. I mean, I actually like you bringing this bill forward because I think we should put all of these things on the table. So, you know, with that, I think we have to start thinking about it differently. But I'm kind of going down the road of Representative, or of Chair Thiessen and even Representative Loffler. I'm trying to figure out, it sounds like what people used to talk about is kind of cafeteria-style benefit set, you know, where you kind of pick and choose what you need and what you don't need and that kind of stuff, which I'm somewhat of a fan of. I guess what I'm concerned is that how that might affect people disproportionately based on their income level. And so people may sometimes make choices not because of what they anticipate that they may need or want, but of what they can pay for. And so that might be part of the discussion, but that might be the intention, but I think that that's part of the discussion, is that Minnesota Care, at least in my mind, was not simply just providing health care insurance, but providing good quality and adequate health care insurance for people who might not be able to pay for it. And so I just like to get your sense or comments on if this is a consumer-driven policy that may be based on what, not what they need, but what they can afford, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, thank you for the question. I mean, that's a very good point, and it's something we took into consideration as we were crafting this bill. If you look at the rate band here and what we do in the legislation on page 2, this scale is adjusted so that between the 133% of federal poverty guideline and the 275%, you get 100% of the subsidy at the midline. If you're below the midline, in other words, the less money you make, the more subsidy you get. So you get more than 100% of this subsidy rate, this base scale, as you have more needs, supposedly. And then as you move up the ladder to where, you know, maybe you're just short of being able to afford something yourself, but you just can't quite, it's a lesser subsidy there. So we've kind of reflected it in that. And then the other point, and I'm glad you brought it up, is there are some who don't think that Minnesota Care right now is a very good benefit set for some people's needs. And one of the marquee issues is the $10,000 inpatient maximum. The policies you can buy on the market don't have that. They have, you know, anywhere from $1 million to $5 million lifetime maximum. So you avoid that situation where a person either ends up in medical assistance or ends up with bankruptcy because they blow through the $10,000 inpatient max. And that is a benefit. I mean, that allows people to do it. For somebody, and this is a response to Representative Thiessen's comment, to assume that people receiving help from the state and going out into the market can't make a good choice about what coverage they need, I think is not a good thing. I don't mean to say, Mr.
Well, that's not what I was saying, Representative Gottwald. What I was saying is that I'm glad you provided this information to me, but if what we're talking about is someone going out and can afford a policy that has a $5,000 deductible and is making $25,000 a year, that may be the only choice they have to be able to afford it. So that's not really making a choice that they have. And then in that sense, we're sending out all this money to the insurance companies. That person is never going to, you know, take the benefit of the insurance policy in some sense. I mean, they'll get the catastrophic risk protection, you know, but I think I think there is a legitimate question about whether we want to just be sending money out to insurance companies with nothing really coming back in return.
Mr. Chair, just in a quick response to that, we've looked at what policies are out there, and as you look at these folders, I think what you'll find is that the amount of subsidy we're looking at, and this bill was never intended to be a give me back to the insurance companies. I know there have been some comments to that effect. I want to set that at rest. It's really a different way of using what's already out there. You know, we've got public programs, we've got private approaches. And what we found is we've been able to line up these dollar amounts, state dollars, and be able to get people good basic coverage, good benefits, so that they won't end up with a $5,000 deductible or even a $3,000 under some of these. Right. I mean, are the benefits going to mirror Minnesota Care? Not in every instance. That can be a good thing. It could be a challenging thing. But what it is for sure is something that is scalable and sustainable for Minnesota and will get people good basic health care coverage.
Okay. We're going to have Jonathan Watson come down. Thanks. And then also Ms. Gruber and Ms. Abderholden, who want to testify, and then we can do a few more questions. Welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. As you well know, there are 16 community health centers throughout the state of Minnesota. About 40% of our patients are uninsured, and another 40% are on a public program. So the purpose today is I just want to comment specifically on Section 2 of this bill. I don't want to get into Section 1, but Section 2, which directs DHS to provide recommendations for a redesign of Minnesota Care for the folks below 133% of poverty. Community health centers, as you might know, have a pretty good experience with these folks. About 75% of our patients have incomes below 100% of poverty. Our association applauds not only the recognition of primary care in Section 2, but specifically citing community health centers as a cost-effective approach to serving this population. For 40 years in Minnesota, we've been kind of fulfilling the goals that is outlined in the three goals in Section 2. First, providing quality care. I know I've shared with you a lot about our low birth weight outcomes, our immunizations, our screenings, just our patient satisfaction in general. So we do believe we provide quality care. Second, reducing emergency room visits. There are national studies for community health centers that cite specifically that our ER use of community health center patients are roughly 30% lower than non-community health center patients. And lastly, reducing reducing the average cost per enrollee. Again, that same national study looked at the medical cost. The average cost per medical CHC user is about 41% lower than a non-CHC user. So we do have the track record to kind of fulfill the goals of Section 2, if you will. Our one concern with House File 3063, I guess, is the capacity of the current community health center system in Minnesota. I'm not here to speak on the capacity of the entire healthcare safety net. There's other providers that should be highlighted as well. Rural health clinics, community mental health clinics, safety net hospitals are all part of the safety net that make the system work. So I'm just here talking about the capacity of community health centers specifically. Some measures of that, we're in 16 of Minnesota counties. However, we serve 50% of the zip codes in the state of Minnesota. People travel great distances, particularly uninsured, to access our services. We'd like to be at 100%. That's always a goal of our association, our health centers, to continue to expand access. The second piece of our capacity you should know of is just the increase in the numbers of uninsured we're seeing as a result of the economy. Just in 2009, we saw roughly about a 10% increase in the numbers of uninsured. This obviously places a financial strain on our ability to expand services into other sites or to provide additional services. And lastly, just the physical infrastructure of community health centers. You know, it is true we received about $10 million through the stimulus funds on the federal level last year to renovate and buy medical equipment. However, we identified as part of that exercise about $36 million in shovel-ready projects that we could just start tomorrow if we had the funding that would expand access to care. So again, we face a capital barrier. It is true that the community health center program expanded dramatically during the Bush administration and continues to do so under the Obama administration. However, similar to the Medicare payment inequalities in our country, Minnesota's community health centers haven't done real well in securing a lot of these federal funds. We rank 47th in terms of total federal funds and roughly 50th in terms of federal funds per person below 200% of poverty, which is kind of the target population for us. So there's a lot of reasons why we didn't receive funding. We get into that later, but that's just the fact of the matter. We haven't grown to the extent that other states have. So finally, you know, this bill signals to us the value of primary care and community health centers, and we're ready to partner with you as you tackle things such as GMC. However, the environment that we currently find ourselves in really affects our ability to expand our capacity. Specifically, I mentioned that 9% increase in the uninsured. The governor's budget has a 40% cut to our community health center appropriation. That money is used for a lot of services that really provides these great results in terms of our enabling services. And lastly, if the Minnesota care cuts the governor's proposal went through, we'd probably project about a 15 to 18% in the numbers of uninsured using our health centers in the next couple years. So we don't want to be expanding services. We just need to really batten down the hatches, in a sense, to maintain the current access points that we have in Minnesota. So again, I don't think we're the silver bullet in the next 16 months to get you out of this mess, but I think we're an effective long-term solution for the state of Minnesota, and with that, that's why we are supportive of Section 2 of this bill. Any questions?
Thank you.
Good, thank you.
Ms. Gruber. And Ms. Everhold, if you want to come down too. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Gruber, president of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. And Representative Gottwald has presented a very interesting bill, very novel bill, very timely bill. Yeah, my concerns really are with the MCHA provisions in the bill. I've not seen any utilization data to indicate to me how well or sick these people are. Potentially, there may be 30,000 more people coming to MCHA. That's more than we have right now. We have about 27,000 people. So I am concerned about just the costs of the folks that are coming. I do appreciate that they have built into the bill that they would like to see MCHA made whole by the savings that they think they can produce going into the healthcare access fund and then, you know, paying MCHA whatever costs we have that are related to these folks. But I have my doubts that it will be enough. I think if this were to work, you'd probably have to have an increase in the provider tax to really assure us that MCHA would be made whole. But I appreciate all the efforts they've made to try to do that. In Section 1, Subdivision 5, there is a provision that I believe states that the agents that help folks get into the various plans and or MCHA would be paid the general standard commercial rate, which I believe is a percent of premium. Well, that's not the way that we pay our agents. We pay them $50, which people say is not enough, and that may be so. But this would greatly increase our costs if we're paying a percent of the premium to the agents. So my concern is with the adequacy of the Health Care Access Fund being able to pay us. It is a good place to help us. As you know, MSHA, I'll just repeat kind of how we're funded. Our members, and there's about 30,000 of them, pay premium above market. It's at about 120% of market now. That gets us about half of what we need to run the pool. And the other portion of the pool's funding comes from a statutory assessment, which has been talked about in this room today. And the assessment goes to any health care company that sells group or individual coverage in the state of Minnesota. And we're looking at about $150 million worth of losses for 2010, and that kind of translates to about 2.5% more premium going on the policies of small business and individuals that buy an insured product, because, you know, as business, the insurance companies that pay our assessment will, you know, shift that over to folks that are going to buy an insured product. So our losses continue to get bigger. We're not really certain how well these folks are that might be coming to us. There may be a lot of pent-up need because that benefit is not real adequate in Minnesota care. So I have concerns there that we don't really know the nature of their health care and the adequacy of the Health Care Access Fund. And finally, I think this is very appropriate for a pilot study, whether it be 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 people. I think with a major program like Minnesota Care and a major new shift, paradigm shift, if you will, to borrow the expressions from Representative Godwalt, I think this is worthy of looking at a pilot project. Those are my concerns, and I commend your creativity.
Thank you. Ms. Averholden.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'll move closer to the mic. Sue Averholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I don't want to pick on Representative Godwalt. I could have testified on a number of the bills today. And really, the discussion today really in some way shows us how little progress we've made in understanding and viewing mental illness as a regular medical illness. And I want to remind you it's an illness that affects 1 in 4 adults and 1 in 10 children. Over 5 years ago, the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group came together recognizing that we needed both a public and private partnership. So it was not only the counties, the advocacy groups in the state, but also the private health plans in Minnesota coming together to say, how is it that we fix our fragile and, in a way, broken mental health system? And one of the recommendations that came out of there was the creation of a model mental health benefit set, which you all passed in 2007 in a bipartisan effort that included these benefits not only under medical assistance, but under Minnesota Care and General Assistance Medical Care as well. And some of the private health plans have begun providing them under their plans as well, which was the ultimate, of course, goal. Some of those services include adult rehab mental health services, children's therapeutic services and supports, which I think are important things to help people in the community. There are a lot of people who do go on Minnesota Care who have a mental illness. We know, particularly of young people in their 20s, perhaps after their first episode, they really don't want to sit there and say, I'm disabled and I'm never going to work again. They use Minnesota Care as a way to access health care. They might work part-time because maybe their depression makes it difficult to work full-time, so they're not going to get coverage through their employer. So they go on Minnesota Care. You know, sometimes they might start out in general assistance medical care and then move to Minnesota Care as they can work part-time. One of the problems with, you know, some of the discussion today was, you know, moving people so they can buy single coverage under health plans. And as it's been said, you don't have to cover mental health services under a single benefit or a single coverage for a single person. I have gone online to try to figure out the various plans in Minnesota and what you get covered, and I got to tell you, it's not all that easy to figure out. There are some plans that say they don't cover mental health services at all. There are others that say, well, we'll cover it after you hit the $4,000 deductible. So it's not that easy to figure out. You know, I understand the concept of consumer choice, but unfortunately, we don't get to choose what illness we develop. You know, you cannot smoke and get lung cancer. You can do all the right things and develop a serious mental illness. You know, I know someone who was a marathon person and developed a strange heart disease and needed a heart transplant. And so I think it's, you know, for an illness that hits so many people, and no one wants to ever say they're going to get it, but it hits you whether you want it or not, we just allow these services not to be covered. And so I think when we talk about consumer choice, we need to talk about how much risk I'm willing to pay for co-payments or for a deductible. But in terms of coverage for services, we actually think, you know, mental health parity is just the first step, and that we've got to start covering mental health benefits, period. The other thing I just want to close by saying is that, you know, you as a legislature can't have it both ways. You can't, at the one hand, create more flexible benefit plans that frankly means that you don't cover mental health services, and then at the same time cut the grants to counties and to mental health centers that are supposed to cover mental health services for people who are uninsured or underinsured. So, you know, there's been a little talk about cost shifting today, but I got to tell you, we just won't have anywhere else to shift people to. Thank you.
Representative Bunn gets the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to abbreviate and follow up further without. First of all, thank you, Representative Gottwald, and your team for bringing this together. I think it really is has some promising ideas that we do need to consider going forward. I'm just going to make comments that maybe you can follow up with later, just to put them on the table, though. First of all, the issue of the subsidy scale that you have here and the percentage and the basis and how you work it, we can't really tell as we can with some other discussions about. We talked before about affordability standards. We don't really know from this the way it's laid out what percentage of their income they're ending up paying for medical coverage, kind of thing. And it'd be nice to kind of do kind of an equivalency table roughly somewhat, so we have a sense of that, as because people are used to talking about it that way, even though it is a defined expenditure one. And moreover, obviously, in statute, it would be hard to put specific numbers like in this, dollar amounts, because you'd have to change them over time to adjust for inflation and stuff, so probably you'd have to do some other formula or percentages to do it rather than the dollar amounts. And that's, we can take it up later, but I just think that's sort of. I also had some concerns that were brought up by the head of MCHA about some of the items in Subdivision 5 in terms of, I don't even know what the override is, so that, but we can take up another time too if we're out of time today, but I'd like further explanation of that, and also whether or not it should be the commercial rate on some of those other things relative to other ways to do that. But beyond that, I think that I think there's some really good ideas for us to keep working on considering, and I hope we do that, and I hope we get some fiscal note work done on this, and so we can see where this takes us, because I do think particularly if although I'm one that would like to see some federal, I think we believe we need reforms at the federal level. If that doesn't go anywhere, we're certainly going to have to look for all kinds of ideas ourselves. And this is one we should have part of that discussion. So if you want to briefly address any of those things, but if not, well, we'll continue to have that conversation as it moves forward.
Why don't we just have the conversations going forward? I'm sorry. Okay. We're just, yeah. But you can have closing comment here.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and we'll respect the time on this. This is an idea whose time has come, frankly, and we are open to any and all concerns and ideas. We've spoken with literally everybody who came up here to testify today. We are in conversation with them. We believe the answers on the mental health side. The fiscal note, I think, is going to help us answer some of the questions for MCHA. Regardless of the concern about what might be done with that money by people outside of our control in this committee, that's a concern, I realize, but that's true of many programs. This is a good idea. It is an option. I shouldn't say an option. It gives options to people in a situation where they need health care coverage and affordability is a factor. The state can help them in this way. We can leverage the marketplace and spreading the risk. We can drive good benefits and get people covered. And we can do it in a way that saves the state a lot of money, which in turn can help us keep health care access fund whole, help take care of MCHA, and make sure that we're taking care of our general assistance medical care population. So I would welcome any questions, concerns, and especially ideas about how we make this bill better going forward. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 3036 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
It has to go to Commerce, unfortunately, because the MCHA piece.
Very good. Okay.
So that we'll just incorporate that, if that's all right.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, although I would invite anybody to answer my question about where the money is in this bill, because that piece still hasn't been made clear to me. So, but we can have that discussion further. So all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill passes. And thank you for all your work today, members. We are adjourned.
Thank you.